It's time for the Scott Rintoul Show.
He holds, he shoots, he scores!
Where the West...
Pettersson up the left wing, steps into a slap shot and scores. Elias Pettersson, oh my word, again.
Is one.
Rebound, Kachuk scores! What a night for Matthew Kachuk.
Let's make it happen. Everything you got, no excuses.
Jackson avoids, spins, he's in. Touchdown, McCaffrey leaps.
Now, here's Scott Rintoul.
Pull my trigger, let me blow your mind.
What's going on? How's the start to your week? We're going to make it better. That's what we do for you every day here. Hope you're having a great Monday. Hope your commute isn't too bad. People in Alberta are saying, what are you talking about? Well, this is the one week a year where... during the winter, Vancouver feels like the rest of Canada, and we actually have to deal with a little bit of snow on the West Coast. Nobody's going to shed tears for that. There might be some tears shed over the course of the weekend, depending on which NFL team you cheer for. I certainly have a friend who is a Texans fan, and it's going to be a long, long week and a long off season for that particular team. We got a lot of hockey to unpack here as well. Crazy weekend. We're going to talk plenty of football. We're going to talk plenty of hockey. Rick Ball joins in the second hour of the program today. Gimme Five is going to take a while today. I just have that sense. The five stories that define the weekend in sports. Let's get to them.
Gimme Five, Scotty.
Well, not surprisingly, coming into this weekend, we do this every Friday for you. We do the six-pack for the weekend. We give you the six biggest games of the weekend. Generally, that's been NFL-focused. That was part of the case, but some of that is NHL-focused. And you're going to hear a lot more hockey make its way into the six-pack for the weekend brought to you by Neutral Vodka Soda. The game we teed up is the game of the weekend. It certainly lived up to it. Let's go.
Giordano, far boards to Lindholm. He steps in and shoots and scores!
So that's your
what a shot by Elias Lindholm, who scores his second goal of the game.
Yeah, that's the second goal of the game. That's the winner on Saturday. And I know we're burying the lead a little bit here, but there is a lot to unpack from Saturday in Calgary. It starts off with what I thought was going to be one of the main storylines. I know it's not the first goal of the game, but it's the first goal that you think about in that game. Connor McDavid, another incredible goal. Puts it in a gear that nobody else seems to have, that we haven't seen with a guy from that talent forever. Pavel Bure, the closest comparable that most people can come up with, but McDavid just puts himself in warp speed in on Talbot, and the finish at the end with how tight he brings his stick into his skates and then is able to put that puck roof job. Just another incredible goal from Connor McDavid. What a week you've had when you score a goal like that and you look back and go, yeah, it's not my goal of the week, though. I scored one better than that. That's pretty incredible stuff. So there's that. Then there's Cam Talbot, who starts again, and he wins again for the Flames. Third consecutive start, his fourth consecutive win overall, and the Flames are rolling. Five in a row, all of a sudden. Top of the division, all of a sudden. Interesting that the Oilers went with Koskinen. I know Mike Smith has played a decent amount lately. Interesting they chose to go with Koskinen. I found that a little bit curious, but these two teams are going to meet in very short proximity, and I would think we'll see Mike Smith in one, if not both, of those games, which leads us to the main talking point, the hot new drama in the NHL starring Matthew Kachuk and Zach Cassian. So let's go through this, and we're going to get into it more at the bottom of the hour, and I want your feedback on this throughout the course of the show today, certainly throughout the course of this first hour. You've got Kachuk leveling Cassian twice. Hits him three times, but leveled him twice. No penalty call on either of the hits. I think there should have been one on the wraparound attempt. I see that as different than the third hit, which ultimately leads to a fight. That, to me, I saw a head contact. I thought there should have been a penalty there. Maybe you disagree. The NHL certainly did. Apparently, they don't see anything wrong with either of those hits. Cassian loses it after the second big one. The third hit overall, but it's the second big one. It's clean, in my opinion. I understand that it's sneaky dirty to a certain degree because there's a defender dealing with Cassian already, but the hit itself, shoulder to shoulder, Now Tkachuk doesn't engage. It's his right, in my opinion, after a clean hit. Cassian can't stop himself at that point. Flames score the game-winning goal on the ensuing power play, and now Cassian has a hearing with the league today to boot. A lot to get to. We'll unpack this even more at the bottom of the hour. Want your thoughts on that. To me, Cassian is going to get one or two games. Why one or two? Because I think the NHL, like the rest of us, whether you agree with went down or not, you would like to see Zach Cassian play that game on January 29th. That's the next time these two teams play. That's the third game for the Oilers coming out of the game on Saturday night. One or two games, that means Cassian's still eligible for January 29th. 5 games from now, as far as the Oilers' schedule goes, it's the Flames again. I don't think he's going to get 3 or more games. The NHL sometimes surprises me. I think we're going to see him play in the first one, if not both of those games, but there are a couple opportunities for Zach Cassian. Cassian, I should say. Suffice to say, and again, we'll get into this in more detail, and I will explain my thoughts even further at the bottom of the hour. Suffice to say, it is on.
Hand to Henry. Henry handles the contact, and there goes Derrick Henry. Henry has got major speed for a big man, and he takes it inside the 10.
Best game of the weekend? No. Biggest shocker of the weekend? Absolutely. And the game that everybody's talking about for that reason. Derrick Henry racks up 195 yards. 195 yards in a playoff game after going for a 182 the week before. The Titans roll up the Ravens in Baltimore. They got up early. Baltimore looked like a team that didn't know how to react. The Ravens were sloppy early. We saw this from both AFC teams that had been resting over the weekend. Kansas City was like this as well. We'll get to them in just a moment. But you saw drop passes early in the game, timing being a little bit off. For the Ravens, missed tackles. There were turnovers. But the real turning points in that game, in Baltimore on Saturday night, a pair of 4th-and-1 gambles by the Ravens that the Titans snuffed out. Baltimore, you understand the confidence in going for it. Baltimore, prior to Saturday against Tennessee, 8-for-8 on 4th-and-1 conversions during the season. Couldn't convert when mattered. A lot of second-guessing about the second 4th-and-1. Should they have kicked the field goal? Makes sense. Would have made it a one-score game at that point. Would have made it 14-6. Instead, they get stuffed again. Say this for the Ravens. They were aggressive in that capacity during the season. They weren't going to change their stripes. That's part of what made Baltimore what it was during the course of the year. But this is also part of what made Baltimore what it was. The biggest deficit that the Ravens overcame in any of their 14 wins this season, 7 points. That's it. And that showed on Saturday night. They got away from their identity way too early. They started throwing the ball all over the field. I know they were loading the box. I understand that's what Tennessee was doing. They're putting 8-man fronts up there. Every once in a while, a 9th guy would creep in there and say, "You're not going to run on us." They got away from their identity too early. They became a pass-happy team. That's not what they are. They don't have the personnel to do that. That's not how Baltimore rolls. Yeah, Hollywood Brown, he's a nice receiver. He's a nice receiver, but he's also a rookie. And he looked like the only guy that could win, the only guy that was going to get any separation. Mark Andrews was banged up. They just don't have the personnel to roll like that. As for Tennessee, they just didn't reinvent the wheel. Run Henry left, run Henry right, run Henry up the middle. Oh, and then let him throw a jump pass on the goal line just to mix it up a little bit. Oh, yeah, and play smash mouth defense. That they brought. Here's the crazy stat associated with Tennessee's win. The Titans are the first team since 1974. Think about where we are as far as the game and the rules for the offense and how pass-happy football is. The Titans are the first team since 1974 to win multiple playoff games in the same postseason without passing for more than 100 yards in either of those games. That is nuts. That is from an era gone by. That is throwback. That is hot tub time machine, whatever you want to call it. But it's Titans in the AFC Championship. Not many people would have predicted that.
Mahomes holding it. Now fires it late. Kelce gets into the end zone, turning his left shoulder. Touchdown, Kansas City. 20 points in lightning fashion.
It's like football didn't sleep for 3 days and then pounded a bunch of Red Bull. That's what that game was in Kansas City yesterday. football off the charts. You didn't know what was happening. The Texans race out to a 24-0 lead. I'm sorry, who? The Texans? The Texans got out to a 24-0 lead, only to find themselves trailing 28-24 at the half. Houston scores 24 points in the first quarter. Kansas City scores 28 in the second quarter. And then the Chiefs throw another 13 on the board in the third, a little 10 more in the fourth. Thank you very much. They advance to their second straight AFC title game. They're going to host it for the second consecutive year as well. And they're not going to see the daunting reputation that they saw last year in the New England Patriots. Tennessee, I'll put my hand up. Yes, I have overlooked this team to a certain degree. I thought they just didn't have enough to get past New England in week one. Proved me wrong. I didn't think they were getting past Baltimore. Again, if they're going to be forced to throw the ball at some point, which Baltimore was unable to make them do, I know Tannehill took his shots. I know he threw the touchdown pass early. Good for him. They passed for 83 yards collectively when you account for the sacks. Total of 91, 88 for Tannehill, three-yard jump pass for Derrick Henry. So, yeah, I overlooked Tennessee. But the Chiefs, that's what we expected. That's the final score maybe you didn't expect, but them beating Houston by 20? Okay, I could see that, absolutely. This game turned on two plays in the first half. The Texans were seemingly in control. They're up 21-0. They're facing 4th-and-1 on Kansas City's 13-yard line, and Bill O'Brien, he's going to go for it. Let's stick a knife in the Chiefs. Let's stick a knife in them early. We're up 21-0. We have a couple of massive special teams play. We're on their 13-yard line. They are reeling. And then he changed his mind. He settled for the field goal. He got conservative. That loosened the grip just a little bit. The grip on the throat that is the Kansas City Chiefs, a team that was gasping for air at that point, loosened the grip. Next Houston possession, up 24-7. Casey's got one back. Hey, comfortable 17-point lead. And now you call a fake punt on your own 31-yard line? Didn't get the first down. Chiefs turned that into another quick 7 points. Houston never recovered from that two-drive sequence. That was it. They were up by 10 points at that time. Felt like they were down 15. They never got back. So now the Chiefs, as mentioned, second consecutive year. They're going to host the Titans. A trip to Miami is on the line in Kansas City next Sunday.
Sabres move the puck ahead, stolen back by Besser. Dishes off. Tanev. Besser shoots. He scores.
Here they come across the wild line. Horvat back off the right wing with a heavy wrist shot. Sent it high and wide to the net. Then Pearson throws it back to the goal. Loose in the crease. They score. Bo Horvat at the side of the net.
After back-to-back blowouts in Florida, the Canucks pick up back-to-back wins over the weekend. That propels themselves up the Pacific Division. It was a very big weekend for the Vancouver Canucks. They outscored the Sabres and Wild by a combined 10-4 count. They win each of those games by 3 goals. You have to remember the context for this. This is a team that had been outscored 14-4 down in Florida. A lot of navel-gazing in the Canucks fan base. Some people looking around saying, oh, 7-game win streak, but now it's all falling apart. What is this team really made of? And it wasn't all Pettersson and Miller offensively. They were certainly key cogs. They always are. But Brock Besser scored a pair. He's got 3 goals in his last 3 games. Bo Horvat, he finished the weekend with 3 goals, including a pair against Minnesota in yesterday's 4-1 win. Quinn Hughes, you may have heard of him. Picked up points in both games on the heels of being voted an All-Star in his rookie campaign. Pretty impressive for the Vancouver Canucks as they rebuild their franchise and they put together a nice young nucleus that this is the third consecutive year the Canucks have sent a rookie to the All-Star game. But as mentioned, it's the context that this happened in. There were people texting the show saying, well, this is where it falls apart. Canucks are going to lose all 5 on this road trip. Here comes the swoon. They stabilize themselves and then some after what happened at the outset of this road trip. They have a 5-gamer, so it finishes on Tuesday in Winnipeg. 2 teams that are in and around that wild card 1, wild card 2 conversation. That's not where Vancouver finds itself in the standing right now, but they're going to be in that same conversation, as are the Flames, as are the Oilers, as we have talked about time and time again on this program, with the tightness of the Pacific Division and being comfortable with being uncomfortable. What was one of the last things I said to you on Friday? I said, it's like the weather in the prairies. If you don't like it, just wait 20 minutes. That's what the Pacific Division is. 48
hours, 72
out.
Pass to Adams. What a throw and catch. What a play. What a time for it.
Back to the Pacific Division in just 1 second. But, yeah, that was Devontae Adams. Aaron Rodgers, that's the pass that almost seals the deal. He needed one more. He had to find Jimmy Graham on another third and long late in the game. We talked about this one possession game. Which quarterback do you want with the ball in his hands? Well, Aaron Rodgers didn't need to go get the final score, but he didn't allow Russell Wilson to have the ball back. And that's what matters here. Aaron Rodgers, Devontae Adams, they were too much for the Seahawks. Adams sets a new franchise record for receiving yards in a playoff game with 160. JerMichael Finley, by the way, was the guy who held that prior to yesterday. A little bit surprising. Packers hang on to beat the Hawks yesterday by 5 points at Lambeau. Seattle dug too big a hole for Russell Wilson this time. Trailed 21-3 at the half. And while the comeback effort was valiant, their fatal flaws revealed themselves in the most crucial parts of the game. They couldn't get off the field on defense on third down. Green Bay finishes the game yesterday 9 for 14 on third down. That includes a pair of third and longs in the final drive, and that's the one that cements the game. Seattle couldn't generate turnovers. That's the fourth consecutive game in which the Seahawks have not taken the ball away. These were fatal flaws that Russell Wilson was able to cover up during the course of the season. He's that good. He's that clutch. He was able to get it done. But this hole was too big. If you look at some of the Seahawks' playoff defeats over Russell Wilson's career, you go back to his rookie campaign, they just got down way too far to Atlanta. Way too far in 2012. They almost roared back. They almost got the job done. But Matt Ryan and the Falcons, they got over. 2016, they get down too far to Carolina. Almost come back, but again, the deficit too big, and it was the same yesterday. You're down 18 points at the half. A team that wants to run the ball, wants to be conservative, and then wants to unbuckle Russell Wilson in the second half and say, go save us. They just got down too far against a team that can grind the clock a little. Green Bay didn't exactly look dominant throughout the course of the game. They played very much to the template that they put in place during the course of the season. Impressive results in less than impressive fashion a lot of times. Same could be said about the Seattle Seahawks. There was a similarity between these two teams heading into this matchup, and you saw some of those similarities unfold yesterday. Devontae Adams was great. Jimmy Graham came up with big plays, and Aaron Jones found the goal line. That's been part of the DNA of the Packers all season long. But they were once again stagnant at times offensively. The defense, it proved porous to the run when Russell Wilson took off. And when he bought time, he was able to find open receivers. Had Malik Turner not dropped that pass, who knows what might have been. But much like the Seahawks, the Packers won in a manner that didn't make you feel overly confident about the way they did so. That's where we're at with Green Bay right now. Now, it's a great throwback matchup coming up in the NFC Championship game. As far as a brand matchup, this is close to as good as it gets. These are some of the big brands in American football, in the NFL. The San Francisco 49ers, the Green Bay Packers. Going head-to-head, down by the Bay, late Sunday afternoon. Should be fun. San Francisco didn't make the top five because San Francisco was by far the most dominant team of the weekend. That game was never particularly close. It looked close on the scoreboard in the first half, but when you really break it down, if you watch that game, Vikings made one real play offensively. That's it. The Vikings had six first downs in that game. And save for a great effort by Stephon Diggs, who was actually in being covered pretty well on the play by Kelo Witherspoon, Diggs makes a great play, great adjustment to the football. DB falls down, 41-yard touchdown. That's basically all the Vikings had. The Niners' defense, which has been their backbone all year long, it got after Kirk Cousins. Nick Bosa was great in his playoff debut. Richard Sherman had an interception. You'll hear from him coming up momentarily. He's always got something to say. You want to talk about a guy with a chip on his shoulder? You'll hear from him in just a little bit of time. San Francisco, Kansas City, those are going to be your favorites. Not surprising coming up next weekend. It's a one-game winner-take-all. Anything can happen, but you understand why those two teams are the clear front-runners coming up this weekend and the front-runners to make it to Miami, which sets up for as an appetizing Super Bowl. It really does. It doesn't feel like there's a loser as far as the draw goes if the Packers win or the Niners win. The Niners have been one of the great stories of football this year. They're the great brand. Kyle Shanahan has been this young mastermind and wizard offensively this year. They've got George Kittle. But on the other side, you've got Aaron Rodgers. And if the NFL gets Aaron Rodgers to the championship game again, if he's in the final, if he's in the Super Bowl and has a chance to get his second in his career, that's good for their brand as well. We all know that Cinderella can be a good story, but I think as far as an attractive football game goes, we can all agree Kansas City getting there feels a lot more appetizing than if Tennessee finds a way again. Great underdog story, the long shot, it can get there. But Kansas City, San Francisco, I would put ahead of Green Bay, but either of those matchups is going to be one that draws very well for the National Football League. That's the top five for the weekend. I do want to get back to the Pacific Division for just one second. After what happened on the weekend with the Battle of Alberta, Vancouver wins a couple of games, Arizona picks up a point in a shootout loss to Pittsburgh. Somehow, between now and what happened Friday, it got tighter. It got closer. We were marveling at the fact there were only 4 points separating first from fifth on Friday. Now 2 points separate first from fifth. 2 points separate first from fifth in the Pacific Division. That is nuts. Calgary and Arizona, they lead it. They both have 55 points. There's Vancouver tied with Vegas. Both have 54 points. Vancouver, games in hand on everybody in the division. One game on some, two games on others. And then you've got Edmonton. Had its win streak snapped by Calgary on Saturday night, but Edmonton's 2 points back of the Flames and the Coyotes. This is nuts. It's exactly what the NHL wants. You want parity, you've got it in the Pacific Division. You can decide for yourself whether the Pacific Division is a lot better than you envisioned or it's just a bunch of somewhat better than average teams, that none of them are great. We've all been waiting for the Vegas push. I have too. I think Vegas eventually separates itself, but we're starting to run out of runway. Eventually, the games are going to pile up to a point where Vegas isn't just going to, they're just not going to have enough time to separate. I think eventually they rise to the top, but they've been struggling, lost three in a row. It's great for the race. It's great for interest. We don't need to have the conversation today which team is the best in the Pacific Division, but it makes for some great matchups coming up here in the very near future. We're going to talk hockey with Rick Ball an hour from now. We'll get into the discussion. I want your text messages. Tell me what you thought of what went down on Saturday night with Cassian, Tkachuk, where you're at with that conversation. I will get into that more. No, I don't think Matthew Tkachuk had to fight. I'll explain why next, and I can already hear you shaking your head. This is the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
Deep as Zach Cassian gets bumped hard by you-know-who, Tkachuk. And Cassian's mad, and here we go. Now there's going to be penalties in the game. They've been going at each other on and off all night, and Zach Cassian is incensed.
Yeah, he was incensed. He was incensed, all right. And he didn't stop. And for that, Zach Cassian has a hearing today. Scott Rintoul, this is the Scott Rintoul Show. Want you in on this conversation. You've got the fan feedback line. You've got the text message inbox. Your thoughts on what went down and where we're at in this conversation in the National Hockey League with these two players specifically. We're not going to have to wait long for the next chapter of this. Provided Zach Cassian is allowed to play in it, I think he will be, whether he gets disciplined or not. And I do think the league will ultimately issue Zach Cassian a 1 or 2 game suspension. That is my thought on this right now. I'll explain in a second. But provided it's 1 or 2 games, who knows, maybe he gets 0, but I think it'll be 1 or 2. Calgary's in Edmonton on January 29th. That's just over 2 weeks from now, in case you're not aware of the date. And then early February, they play again. So we're not going to have to wait long for this. Let's get into it. And I want you in on this conversation. There are the consequences of what happened in the game, and then there's the broader conversation moving forward. Let's start with what happens in game. The confines of what went down Saturday night. I don't like the first hit. I know there were three, so I guess I'm really talking about the second. I don't like the hit where Cassian is trying to wrap the puck around for a goal, and Tkachuk blows him up. Now, the NHL says that's a legal hit. I think that one is illegal. Doesn't really matter what I think, I suppose. I don't govern the game. The NHL does. But I think there should be a penalty on that play. I see contact with the head. I don't think there's any acknowledgement of the puck whatsoever. It's just, I'm going to take you out. That's what it felt like watching it. From what I can tell, as I said, it looks like he hits Cassian in the head. That hit right there, to me, should be a penalty. Wasn't called in the game. And so it leads to what happened on the second hit, which I think is clean. Now, I understand that it's a sneaky, dirty hit. It's a sneaky, dirty hit because Cassian's engaged with another checker at the time. You don't expect a guy to come down from the wing. Although maybe, I guess, after what happened earlier in the game, maybe you should be expecting Matt Tkachuk to come down from the wing. But you've got somebody tying you up. You don't think the winger's going to come in. But that one, to me, is different than the one I just talked about because the hit that ultimately leads Cassian to snap, that one is shoulder to shoulder. That one is made much more, in the way I watch it, of dislodging the puck carrier from the puck, which is what it's supposed to be. As I mentioned, it's sneaky dirty. The first one, I think, has to be a penalty. They didn't call it in the game. And then it leads to whatever happens next because Tkachuk has already blown up Cassian. He's got him a couple of times, and nothing's happened. So when he gets another opportunity, what's he going to do? He's going to do it again. He's a very physical player, and he's a player who does everything in his power to get under the skin of the opposition. And he is loved for that by one fan base, reviled by a bunch of others. But nothing happened on the first hit, so why isn't he going to do it again? He is. Even though I think the last one is the cleanest of the hits he delivers. But with the backdrop of the earlier hit, we all understand why Cassian had had enough. We all understand why Cassian loses it there. Is it sneaky dirty? Yeah, it's sneaky dirty. But there are a lot of sneaky dirty things that fall into the gray area in physical sports. So then it leads to, should Tkachuk have to fight? I don't think he has to for a couple of reasons. I understand the tradition of the game, but here's why I don't think he has to hit after that particular fight after that particular hit. I just described to you, I think that last one's clean. Sneaky dirty? Maybe. Clean? Yes. He's also getting his team a power play in a 3-3 game. That's situational awareness. He knows what he's doing, and he's not going to take the bait. You can say there's no honor, but as far as the ultimate goal for him, which is to get under the skin of the opposition and ultimately win the game, he's doing exactly that. Here's the other part of it. There's a lot of time left for a pound of flesh. And I understand exactly why Cassian has trouble recognizing that in the moment. I understand he's just had enough, and come hell or high water, Zach Cassian's going to get his right now. But I've never been a big believer in the you have to fight if you deliver a big hit philosophy. I understand the tradition. I think the tradition is stupid. I do. And here's why. You're playing a game, in the case of hockey, in the case of football, where you have been empowered with legal forms of assault. Here you go. You often hear somebody say that and watch a game. Well, if you did that on the street, you'd go to jail. Yes, you would. A lot of things that you do in hockey or in football, you would go to jail for, and everybody's been given the rules of engagement. And if you do it within the rules of that engagement, you're not going to jail. You're not even going to the penalty box. So you play a sport where there is a legal form of assault available to you. There are so many different ways to me that Cassian can settle the score. I understand why he snapped. I get it. Sometimes reason goes completely out the window. Now, Cassian can come back and spend the next couple of shifts looking for Tkachuk if that's what we want. Last time I checked, Tkachuk has the puck a decent amount of time. So he's going to have it at some point, and Cassian can go after him. Now, if the officials or Tkachuk, if nobody's going to intervene, if nobody's going to allow Cassian to get his and Tkachuk's not going to accept the invitation, there are plenty of other talented Flames that Zach Cassian can run over. Now, that will get Matt Tkachuk's attention. If Zach Cassian says, okay, you guys aren't going to penalize this, and I can't afford to put my team in a bad spot, and you're not going to fight, okay, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go get Johnny Gaudreau. Maybe that'll wake you up. Maybe that'll change your behavior. There are a lot of different ways to go about it, but this is the time-honored tradition. This is the way that it often goes down in the National Hockey League. I'm not a big believer in you deliver a legal hit, you have to fight because we just didn't like it. No, I'm not a big believer in that. Whether you think all of the hits were illegal, whether you think they weren't, you let me know. I heard a good counterpoint, again, to those who would say, well, he has to fight no matter what. Let's switch the jerseys for a second. We won't use Connor McDavid. Connor McDavid's not going to drill anybody like that. The other guy might, though. The other guy in Edmonton, he might. He doesn't play as physical as often as a guy like Matt Tkachuk does, but Leon Draisaitl, big man, plays a more physical game. If Leon Draisaitl drills Milan Lucic, would Oilers fans say, no, Draisaitl's got to fight him? No, they wouldn't, because they wouldn't want their star player fighting him. That's not what they would want. They wouldn't want to have the risk of Leon Draisaitl getting beat up, getting injured, and doing what he does best, which is score goals and put up points. I've got this one coming in. What Tkachuk did was bush league. Cassian should have taken his head off. The hit was dirty into the head. The NHL has no clout against head injuries. If they suspend Cassian, not Tkachuk, his dad has friends in the NHL. That's from Paul. I agree, Paul, that the first wraparound hit should have been penalized. That's where we can agree. That hit should be penalized to me. I don't think that's a hit you want in the game. I don't know why the NHL came out afterwards and said, no, those two hits are fine. But that's what they've decided. Paul goes on to say, the NHL is not going to protect players. They need to protect themselves. It's Bush League. Depends who you are. They should adopt the double IHF rules. That's a real league concerned about headshots. What if Cassian was on the ice for a second? After the second headshot, what do we call? Do we get another Bertuzzi incident? Torgi and Langley. I agree. I don't like when you deliver a clean hit. You need to answer the bell, but that wasn't a regular hockey hit. On top of that hit earlier, he runs around too much and doesn't answer the call. That is the reputation that people who aren't a fan of Matthew Tkachuk, aren't a fan of the Calgary Flames, that's certainly like this. No, Joey, that's how I feel. Joey thinks that because this show is being broadcast across two provinces and one of the markets that we are doing this show in right now, that is why I have this take. No, that's not why I have this take. Not at all. I don't like the first hit. If this was simply pandering, I tell you everything that Matt Tkachuk did on Saturday night was great. It was fine. More of it, please. I don't like the first one. I don't like it. I think it should be a penalty. I think the NHL should have looked at it, quite frankly. But they've decided it's not. They're going to look at Zach Cassian, and that's all they're going to look at. I understand why Cassian has a hearing. Even though street justice tells you that maybe he shouldn't, from an optics point of view and from a league point of view, you understand why you can't have that scene not being dealt with somewhat punitively. Now, Cassian, within the game, the punishment served its purpose. Calgary gets the win by a direct result of what Cassian did. But the league doesn't want the specter of, oh, yeah, we're going to let guys do that. Again, you can nip this in the bud if you call a penalty on the first play. Take care of it right there. We're not even talking about this now. So I'm not sure why they came out and said that that hit is fine. They obviously have a different view of it than I do. I think he got head. Someone sends this. I think you'd call a charge on either hit, but we have to put the headshot argument to rest. The league would have loved to throw the book at Tkachuk as well, so you know they looked in super fine detail to see if there was head contact. Matt says, I've seen multiple ex-players speak on this situation. Very few have supported Tkachuk, Solani, Ferraro, Stock, Upshaw, Strudwick, and Larocque. I agree with you, Matt. They don't like that hit. I don't like the first one. The second one, I think more guys are okay with than the first one I described, but they don't like the thought of a winger coming down from that position hitting a guy who's vulnerable. I completely understand that. Completely understand. I see a difference between the two hits, but I respect the opinion of those who played the game and don't like that hit at all. Keep your texts coming in. Keep the conversation going. Let's get to what they're saying.
Bro, what are you talking about, man?
What are you saying?
Not saying anything.
You're saying something?
I guess that's what I'm saying, Brooksy.
Here's what they're saying.
We got to start with those two, don't we? We have to start with those two. Here's Zach Cassian. Follow what happened on Saturday night.
If you're going to hit like that, you have to answer the bell every once in a while. Like, it's especially one, two, three, and he got me in the third. He followed me in the corner, right? Like, he's clearly trying to target me, which I like. Like, I'm standing here. I love that stuff. I wish we could play him in a day and a half in, like, a playoff series, right? It was fun for me. We lost the game. It sucks, but all in all, he's just a young punk that has to figure that aspect out in the game. It's sad because he's a pretty good player, but he's a to be honest, straight up. That's the definition of it. He wouldn't fight me 2 years ago. Said I was a fourth liner. Now I have 13 goals. What's the excuse now?
The bleeped out part there is Zach Cassian calling Matt Tkachuk a little kitten, if you will. He dealt with it in a pretty real manner. Hey, he's a good player. If you're going to run around, every once in a while, you got to stand up. I understand the thinking. I understand the tradition. I understand the quote-unquote code. I get it. I get why players don't like it. I think the officials are the ones that could have changed this. And I think we also have a very hypocritical relationship with this. We really do. We don't want to see guys hurt. We don't want to see guys concussed. We don't want to see head injuries. None of us want any of that. However, we kind of liked what we saw on Saturday. We liked the rivalry. We don't like it when it goes too far. You might not like every aspect of it, but you're watching the return engagement. Here's Matthew Tkachuk.
Yeah, I mean, well, if he, you know, doesn't want to get hit, then stay off the tracks. You know, he's caught him three times there, so I think he'd learn after the first one, but if he wants to react like that, we'll take the power play, we'll take the game winner, and we'll move on to first place.
And that's the justification for it right there. So is there a calmer head in all of this? Is there a cooler head? And that's the conversation you'd love to know. Has it occurred between the NHL and the officials? I know what they said publicly. Do they feel the same way privately? Do they talk to their officials and say, guys, here's how you could have diffused this entire thing. You should have done something about it on the wraparound attempt. But once that got away, this is what it leads to. And do we want that as a league? As I said, I believe we have a hypocritical relationship with this as fans. A lot of people loved what they saw. They loved the rivalry. They loved the physicality. They might not like every aspect of it. And you probably come out on this one side or the other. Someone sends this in. Why do you think he targeted Cassian? He only targets players. He knows it gets to them. He knows there's a high possibility of retaliation and a power play. Think about it, people. No question. Unsigned text. Absolutely 100%. Matthew Tkachuk is very, very good at this. This is part of his job. It's part of what makes him so effective. It's part of what makes him so unique. There are very few guys like this playing in the NHL. It's a very small category. It's kind of the Tom Wilson category, but this is a far more skilled player than Tom Wilson, who can hold his own in goal scoring and offense as well. But it's a very small subcategory. And that's part of what makes Matthew Tkachuk so effective. Keep the feedback coming in. We'll continue to read your text. We'll continue to get into this conversation. Mentioned the playoff games on the weekend. Richard Sherman gets himself an interception. And Richard Sherman had something to say at the podium afterwards as well.
I get tired of hearing, oh man, he's a zone corner. I get tired of hearing the excuses for why I'm great. It was man coverage. I covered the man. I picked the ball off. In the playoffs, in big games, I show up. I show up year in, year out, whether it's 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014, unless I tear my Achilles, I'm out there and I'm doing my job at a high level. And I think I get tired of the excuses, you know, for why I'm good. Oh my God, they're playing zone. Oh my God, it was this guy. Oh my God, receiver slipped. Oh my God, it's like, why don't other people get those ops then? You know what I mean? There's a lot of other corners out there who have the same ops I have, you know.
Why do you think that is?
It's odd. It's like people got frustrated that I was so confident early on in my career. I was so confident early on so that people wanted me to fail. And when I didn't fail, it's like, how do we tear him down in other ways? How do we find a way to tear him down? You know what I mean? How do we find a way to rip his game apart? Because I'm too consistent on a year-in, year-out basis. You know, since I got in the league, every category that matters to a corner, I'm number one in. Completion percentage, interceptions, touchdowns against, yards, like completion percentage, passer rating. You know, if that was any other corner, it wouldn't even be a conversation. But, you know, I just get tired of it. You know, in the playoffs, I played in 13 games now, zero touchdowns given up, three interceptions. Like, show me somebody else doing it like that. And then I'll enjoy the argument. You know what I mean? But there isn't.
Nothing he said is incorrect. People don't like the fact that he's a self-promoter. People don't like the fact that Richard Sherman makes the chip on his shoulder bigger than perhaps it actually is in reality, but it works for him, doesn't it? It always has. And those who don't like Richard Sherman, they're going to hear that and they're going to dislike him more, and he feeds on that. He's a smart guy. He understands not just the football game, he understands the marketing game. He understands the PR game. He gets all of that. He knows exactly what he's doing when he delivers these clips. Now, nothing he said is factually incorrect. People just don't like the way the message comes across sometimes. The man has been incredible for a very long time, and there's a lot of people who thought he'd never get back to the level he's at right now. Now he's back in an NFC Championship game. We'll see where it goes this coming Sunday. His former teammate, he's done, and you would think done for good. We thought that was the case with Marshawn Lynch prior to this mini comeback that happened. Marshawn not going to go get to see Richard Sherman in the NFC Championship game. And the beginning of his press conference yesterday started the way a lot of Marshawn Lynch press conferences and media availabilities have started over the years. Not answering much, but then he decides to dispense some wisdom.
But look, I'll say like this, though, right? It's a vulnerable time for a lot of these young dudes, you feel me? They don't be taking care of their chicken right, you feel me? So if it was me, or if I had an opportunity to let these little young sahabs know something, I say take care of y'all money, African, because that shit lasts forever. Now, I done been on the other side of a retirement, and it's good when you get over there and you can do what the you want to. So I tell y'all right now, while y'all in it, take care of y'all bread. So when y'all done, go ahead and take care of yourself. So while y'all at it right now, take care of y'all bodies, you know what I mean? Don't take care of y'all chicken, you feel me? Don't take care of y'all mentals, because look, we ain't lasting that long. You know, I had a couple of players that I played with that, you know what I mean? They no longer here no more, they no longer. So I mean, you feel me? Start taking care of y'all mentals, y'all bodies, and y'all chicken for when y'all, you know, ready to walk away. You walk away and you be able to do what you want to do.
There are certain things that certain guys say and you can't quite emulate it. And if you tried to deliver the exact same speech, you'd look like a fool, but it kind of works for Marshawn Lynch, doesn't it? He's got a style that's all his own. People are asking right now, if you haven't heard that clip, chicken, what is he? Chicken, money. That's what he's referring to. Make sure that you take care of your money. Make sure you take care of your head, because once you get through this, there's a pretty good life on the other side. Pretty good advice, actually. There's lots of guys who get into pro sports and they have a really good time because they don't think the tap is ever getting turned off. Marshawn Lynch is a guy who's taking care of his money, played a brutal sport, played a brutal position, and played it in a very physical manner. And you wonder how he's feeling after all of it. It's a pretty good life on the other side. But if you watch that press conference in its entirety, it just all of a sudden he decides, here, I'm going to lay some wisdom on you guys. You guys asked me about five questions that I answered with about eight words total. And then here's what I came here to say. So I'm going to say it right now. Players love him. Love him. They will do anything for Marshawn Lynch. And they have the ultimate respect for that guy. And even though he looked more like feast mode than beast mode at the end, just not in playing shape, let's be honest. Four touchdowns in three games, can't take that away from him, but just didn't look like the same old guy. The amount of respect he commanded in that locker room, incredible. Last but certainly not least, there were a couple of very emotional announcements over the course of the weekend. One of them occurred on CBS, the other occurred on Fox, and they had to do with two head coaches being given the news on camera that they are off to Canton. Bill Cowher was the first. That happened Saturday. On Sunday, it was Jimmy Johnson's turn.
The only thing I can think of is all the assistant coaches that have worked for me, all the great players that have played for me, they're the reason I'm here. And they're the reason I can't talk.
All right.
No.
Where's your Bob?
I mean, this is so special to me because when you put in the work that we put in, It's nice to know people appreciate it.
Jimmy Johnson didn't have the ability to talk very much. He was that overcome with emotion. Bill Cowher was kind of the same. You saw him tear up. You saw him close his eyes, try to sink in the gravity of the moment. You understand what it means to those two people, how much of an honor it is for those two guys who got inducted. And for a guy who comes across as pretty macho a lot of the time, both of them, in fact, come across that way. The emotion of the moment getting to them. It was fun to watch over the course of the weekend. Not the way we normally see guys learn the news, but it was pretty fun to watch on both of those broadcasts for that special moment to be shared, not only with those that were in studio with them, in the case of Cowher, his daughters came to see him as well on set, but just to share that with all the football fans who watched them for so many years. You've got lots to say on the Tkachuk-Cassian incident. I completely understand why. We're going to get to your text in just a second. Then we're going to start talking some NFL football. Rick Ball joins me as well. Get into it right here on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Welcome to the Scott Rintoul Show.
From the two, the ground again. Touchdown. Tevin Coleman takes it in.
They can run the ball. Different guy every week. That's what it seems like with the San Francisco 49ers. They will ground and pound you. Not in the same way Derrick Henry. That's one guy, beast to tackle, and boy, is he on a roll. First player to go for a 180 or more in three consecutive games, and two of those are playoff games on the road at New England, at Baltimore. Talk about showing up, and he has a touchdown pass in there to boot. We're going to get into the all of the NFL talk after the divisional round of the playoffs are down. We're down to the final four. It's San Fran hosting Green Bay, Kansas City hosting Tennessee. Both games go next Sunday, Super Bowl 2 weeks following that. I'm Scott Rintoul. This is the Scott Rintoul Show. Benjamin Albright, you can follow him on Twitter at AlbrightNFL. He joins me in 4 minutes' time, and we will get into that. We'll get into what the Browns have done with their hiring of a head coach, whether Bill O'Brien should still have a gig in Houston after what happened in Kansas City over the course of the weekend. But as mentioned, it's not surprising. You knew as soon as it happened on Saturday night that it would be a lightning rod for conversation for at least a couple of days to come, and it is here again this morning. Zach Cassian, Matthew Tkachuk, a lot of people look at these in completely polarizing fashion. Some people have no problem with either of the hits. They think Cassian's whining, got to control himself. Oilers fans complain about everything. And then there's the other side. No, Tkachuk, not only were the hits predatory, not only were they dirty, he's got to stand up, he's got to fight for himself. Where do you come out on that? We're getting a lot of feedback on this topic, so I want to get some of your texts in. Someone just sends in, has to fight, must. Sign your text. Would love to give you credit when you text in. The first one says the first hit was to the head and a player in a vulnerable position. If that was Monahan or Johnny Hockey, you guys, as in Flames fans, would be calling for 10 games. Then there's the other side. Noah in Calgary says, by the logic Oilers fans are using, if McDavid took a run at Benny Lucic, he'd have to answer the bell. It's not how it works. Skilled guys shouldn't have to fight up their weight class. Also, none of those hits were dirty. Cassian has way more controversial hits. That's from Noah in Calgary. Kip from Chilliwack in with this. I think the first hit on Cassian might have been penalized as a charge, but the second was completely within the rules. It was ridiculous to think he should have to, quote, answer for it. Here's the problem, though. The NHL's definition of charging is so nebulous and imprecise, it's impossible to define what was wrong with the first hit, even after the fact. I don't like hits like the first one where the receiving player is so vulnerable, but nothing will change in the NHL starts to set precise parameters on what is within the rules and what is not. That's from Kip in Chilliwack. He's right about charging. Sometimes they call a charge, sometimes they don't. How many strides does it have to be? It's certainly at the discretion of the official. I think we can all agree on that. The officials could have changed this situation considerably, and you'd love to know what that conversation is like between the league, the officials involved in the game, the officials in general. How do we handle a situation like this next time? If they do penalize that first play, the wraparound attempt, I know that Tkachuk got him three times, so overall in the sequence, this is the second one. Nobody's really talking about the first hit, so we're talking about hits two and three. Hit number two, it's a wraparound attempt by Cassian, doesn't see Tkachuk coming, and Tkachuk goes after him. Some people think there's contact to the head. I fall on that side. Other people do not. They don't think there's anything contact with the head, that it's a secondary point of contact, and his head zips around as a result of contact somewhere else on the body. But I think we can agree, if they penalize that hit, the third one doesn't happen. We don't find ourselves in a situation where Zach Cassian is losing it on Tkachuk. Now, even the staunchest of Oilers fans or Tkachuk haters, whichever camp you find yourself in, we also can all agree that while Cassian wants his pound of flesh in that moment, while he wants blood for what's just happened, when Kachuk's an unwilling combatant, he's got to stop. He has to. As difficult as it might be, as much as he wants to get his, as much as he might loathe the fact that Tkachuk isn't owning up for what he's done, he's got to stop. He can't keep going. And that's why he's going to go see the league about it. My opinion is, whether you think it's deserved or not, they're going to give him a 1 or 2 game suspension. A lot of that has to do with optics. I think that's what's going to happen here. But we'll see. I think that's what's going to go down. From an optics standpoint, they don't want that look. They don't want the look of a guy throwing punches while a player is going down to the ice, has chosen not to throw his gloves off, is helmetless. They don't like the optics of that. But I also think they like the juice that comes from what we saw on Saturday night. So I think it's going to be 1 to 2 games so that Zach Cassian's available to play the next time these two teams are scheduled to meet, which is January 29th in Edmonton. Ali in Calgary. To all the guys that say Tkachuk runs around, doesn't answer the call, delusional. After he elbowed Doughty the following game, they fought. Same with Braden McNabb. So stop saying he won't answer the bell. That's from Ali in Calgary. Keep your feedback coming in on this particular subject. I understand why there are polarizing opinions. We're going to solicit those of Rick Ball at the bottom of the hour. See what he thinks, see if he had any problem with any of the hits, with anything that followed. Knowing Rick, I know that he's not going to be on the side of, oh yeah, Zach Cassian was within his rights to keep wailing away at Matthew Tkachuk. I understand why people want the street justice. I understand why they want that feeling of vigilantism. I get it. I completely get it. But at some point, he has to stop. Cease and desist. Let's turn our attention back to the National Football League. It wasn't wild card weekend, but man, there were a couple of wild games. Benjamin Albright, always in on the NFL, one of the NFL insiders, on the radio in Denver as well. Like having him on this program to talk about this sort of thing. Ben, thank you very much for doing this. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How about yourselves?
Very well. Wild weekend. Let's get into the upset of the weekend, Titans over the Ravens. You called it. You've got the receipts to prove it going into the weekend. What did you see in this matchup that made Baltimore vulnerable?
Well, you had an offense that in Tennessee that's multidimensional. It starts with the power run. It starts with the with Derrick Henry and just running it down your throat. So they can ball control you and keep it close. And then on the defensive side of the football, they have an aggressive attacking front seven and good defensive backs. And so what they did was kind of try to blow up the mesh points and 1-3 blitzer at Lamar Jackson and force him to throw it quick, not allow that deep stuff to develop. There were times they didn't get there, and we saw a couple of those deep passes get completed. But it looks like they've kind of tried to lay a new blueprint for beating Lamar Jackson, and you know it appeared to work, and certainly it did work in the end. So, you know, I felt like that they were the team that just matched up with Baltimore very well. I felt like if Baltimore and Kansas City played, it'd probably be a shootout, and, you know, you'd have to give the edge, I think, to Baltimore and Lamar Jackson. But I felt like Tennessee was a bad matchup for Baltimore, and ultimately it worked out.
Yeah, it certainly did. And Baltimore looked like a fighter that had gone into the ring a little too cocky, a little too rested, took a couple of punches, and then panicked. Did the Ravens panic when they got down early?
Yeah, I felt like they were pressing a little bit. Lamar Jackson looked a little shook out there. I don't know if that was him getting popped early. I don't know if that was a result of his receivers dropping some passes. I think Baltimore had 6 drop passes in that game. He looked a little shook. And, you know, the thing about playing Baltimore style of offense is when you get down and you've got to throw the ball, you've got to throw the ball outside the numbers, you've got to have great accuracy. And we did not see that from Lamar Jackson. I think both of his interceptions came on outbreaking routes toward the sideline when he was forced to make those throws. One of them was tipped by a receiver. The other one was just bit on by the safety. And, you know, I think in the end, we kind of see some of the flaws that Lamar Jackson is going to have to clean up this offseason in order to become the guy that everybody thinks he can be.
And he's going to win the MVP in spite of all of that after the incredible season. This is a team that, despite winning 14 games, in any of those 14 wins, the most it ever trailed by was 7 points. Is there something to be said for having to encounter more adversity over the course of the regular season?
I think so. I think having the confidence that you're able to bounce back from something is certainly good. Part of the thing about Baltimore coming into that game is they played a pretty soft schedule. You go back and look, they played a lot of weak teams. I believe they beat up on Miami, Cleveland twice. They played a Pittsburgh team that wasn't very good twice. They played a lot of middling to really bad football teams. And, you know, I felt like it may have been a bit of a disservice, at least in where people set expectations. They are a good football team, don't get me wrong, but playing bad teams like that will pad the totals a little bit. And, you know, you can look at week one and week two of the season and see that he just beat up on bad football teams.
Benjamin Albright of KOA in Denver joining me this morning talking NFL playoffs over the course of the weekend. Let's stay in the AFC, I should say. What's the most surprising thing about the way the Chiefs game unfolded to you?
Well, I expected Kansas City to win, but I didn't expect it to happen that way. They spotted the Texans a 24-point lead and still were never in any danger of losing that game. That was one of the most ridiculous things I think I've ever seen, in that a team was down 24-0 and absolutely just put it to the other team. Like 24-0, that's insurmountable for 80% of the teams in the league, maybe 90% of the teams in the league. And Kansas City just went out there and went on a 51-7 run. That is mind-boggling. There were some poor decisions made by Bill O'Brien to continue to give Kansas City momentum to build right back into the thing. So it goes to show that, sometimes you just got to play to what your team has. If you got a 24-0 lead, the way to protect that is to go for it on fourth down, not go for fake punts. And if you're going to run a play on fourth down, maybe you want to do it with your quarterback who can actually throw the ball instead of trying to trick people.
It's easy in the heat of the moment to call for a guy's job. You step back, you say, okay, Houston won its division, won a playoff game, got out to a great start on the road in a tough environment to win in Kansas City. Hey, season successful overall. Deshaun Watson came out after the game and said, Bill O'Brien, he's the right coach for this team. He got Watson's endorsement. Would Bill O'Brien get yours if you were running that team?
Well, no, and we would have gotten rid of Bill O'Brien already. They won't get rid of him this year. There's no general manager to fire him, and all these other teams have already done coaching searches and poached all the good assistants, so it doesn't make sense to fire Bill O'Brien at this point. But if you go back and look, the Houston Texans were a team that was absolutely terrible on the script all year. Yesterday, I think, was their first offensive explosion early in a game. They were terrible on the script all year. They got off the script, and the improvisational ability of Deshaun Watson carried that football team. And that's telling. You know, you can look at what a coach, the game plan a coach has put together the first 15 plays or so, and they're bad on it, and then all of a sudden you get off of that, and then they're a good team. Well, that's your quarterback and your team carrying a coach, not the other way around. So I think Bill O'Brien is being carried by Deshaun Watson right now, and I don't know how much longer that's going to last. As far as Deshaun endorsing him, I mean, your quarterback's kind of got to come out and say that about your head coach. I mean, what is he going to say? Oh, we hate the guy, but he's going to be here next year.
Totally agree. I feel exactly the same way. I think they'd be better off if they got someone who's a better fit with Deshaun Watson, a better play caller in Houston. As for the Kansas City Chiefs, what difference do you see between a team that lost in overtime last year in the AFC Championship game and the team that is going to host that same AFC Championship game this year?
Oh, it's all on the defensive side of the ball. The offense, we know, can score in spades. It's about the defense this year. Last year at halftime, Pat Mahomes got in the defensive coordinator, then defensive coordinator Bob Sutton's face, and told him, we're not going to do this bleep again. And ultimately, they lost with a defensive letdown. This year, Steve Spagnuolo's come in. They've installed a different defense. It's more attacking instead of being reactive. They force sacks. They force teams into third and long type situations, and then they can get those corners back there to ball hawk and create turnovers. I think what Spagnuolo has done is a much, much better fit for what they're doing than Bob Sutton.
Benjamin Albright joining me talking NFL playoffs after we whittle our way down to the final four. Most impressive performance of the weekend as far as dominance has to belong to the San Francisco 49ers. It doesn't have all the bells and whistles of some of the other games. Do you see any weakness in the 49ers right now?
Honestly, if there's a weakness, it's in their passing game. Jimmy Garoppolo is kind of more of a caretaker. I know everybody thought he was the heir apparent to Tom Brady, but he's more of a caretaker, and I think that the way that offense is kind of sets him up more than he sets them up. Kyle Shanahan is probably the most creative run game caller in football right now, and it's really interesting. He is to the run game what a lot of these other coaches are to the pass game right now with their concepts. The run game is really what makes San Francisco go. So if you could shut that down and force them to pass, that's how you have to beat them.
To me, Emmanuel Sanders has changed that passing game completely. Would you agree?
I think he gives them a better option as a more reliable move-the-sticks receiver. He still can't, compensate for the fact that Garoppolo holds the ball too long at times and makes some, some poor decisions with the ball. But overall, yes, he is definitely a weapon. And adding him, while he may not have the wheels that he had in years past, he has reliable hands and finds a way to work himself open.
Did you come out of the Green Bay-Seattle game more impressed with the Green Bay Packers or feeling as though the Seahawks let one get away?
I thought the Hawks let one get away. That's the one I missed from this weekend. I had Seattle in that game. I thought they could have pulled that off. Russ is a magician. I think, honestly, if it hadn't been for the statistical accumulation of Lamar Jackson, Russ Wilson probably deserves the MVP. We're just so used to Russ doing what he does that, that we kind of gloss over how impactful and how good he really is because we've seen him do it year to year. I didn't come away as impressed with Green Bay as I thought I would. And, my early gut says that San Francisco is going to win that matchup.
As for Russell Wilson and the Seattle Seahawks, where would you lay the blame of that loss?
It's tough. I don't think you can assign blame any one particular place. There were some execution issues on the players. There were some play calling on the coaches I felt was suspect. There's plenty of blame to be passed around. I don't know that I could assign it one particular place. I think they'll go back, look at the tape, and, they've got a smart coaching staff, smart players. They'll look at this and say, hey, here's where we goofed up. Let's fix this for next year and make a run.
Is there a problem with the philosophy? Quite often we see Seattle put itself in holes only to come back and use the magic of Russell Wilson, as you described it a couple of minutes ago, to win games. Do you have any issue with Seattle's philosophy overall?
Yeah, I think they're overly conservative. I think there's too much of a dedication to establishing the run early. I understand where they're coming from. Most of the league has moved to spread, establish the pass, and if you've got a power run football team, a lot of times the defenses you're playing are going to be a lot lighter because people have adapted to the passing game. So you can get that run game going early and really build off play action for your guys like DK and Tyler Lockett. But there are times where I feel like that maybe throwing on first down would be more advantageous. Just as teams are biting the run, and instead of getting that 2-3 yard gain, maybe you can get a big chunk play on an early down and move the ball down the field, put yourself in a better position to score.
In conversation with NFL insider Benjamin Albright here on the Scott Rentoul Show, Kevin Stefanski, he gets the head coaching gig in Cleveland. What do you think of the fit?
Well, he was the guy Paul DePodesta preferred last year when they ultimately went with Freddie Kitchens. DePodesta made a power play kind of toward the end of this season after largely being ignored the last couple of years. He originally wanted to hire Sean McDermott when he came on board there. Jimmy Haslam overruled that, wanted a football guy, quote unquote, and went with Hugh Jackson. We saw how disastrous that was versus how good Sean's been. Then the situation last year, Paul DePodesta said, we needed to go different separately. Freddie's has been fine, but we need to go in a different direction. Let's get Stefanski instead. They went with Kitchens. We saw the disaster this season was. So DePodesta's kind of pushed all his chips to the middle of the table and said, look, let me do what it is that I've been telling you that we can do. Let me get the coaching and the staff in place that I want to get in place, and let me see how I can run this thing. And if I'm right, I'm right. If I'm wrong, fire me. And so they're going to be bringing in Stefanski. They're going to be bringing in Andrew Berry as the general manager. I don't know if that's announced yet, but that they're going full on Paul DePodesta, and he holds the cards in that organization.
What is the biggest challenge you see right now with the Cleveland Browns?
Well, I think it's getting buy-in from players when the going gets tough. You know, if you start next season and you start off losing a couple of games, you could have that old "here we go again" from guys that are used to losing from, you know, from coaching turnover time and time again. So it's going to be important to get buy-in and sustained buy-in if they don't have early success with Kevin Stefanski.
Early success is what Baker Mayfield had. Everyone after the rookie season went, okay, there's a franchise quarterback. A lot of people walked that back after what they witnessed this year. Where are you on Baker Mayfield?
He's a franchise quarterback. He's just not – he was not a fit for the offense that they were running. And to be honest with you, the offense they were running wasn't a fit for the offense they were running. They would practice stuff all week and then turn around and do different things during the game. They were trying to throw vertical all the time with a rhythm passer. Baker's a guy you got to get at rhythm early. You know, they didn't go tempo as much, which is kind of Baker's thing. They did pretty well in the run game, but they didn't really set things up with it. It was just kind of a, well, we're going to run it here now, and then we're going to go back to trying to chuck it deep and expose our quarterback that didn't have the offensive line to be able to throw deep. So if they can shore up that line this offseason, you're going to see an offense that looks a lot more like Gary Kubiak's, you know, out of them with the zone run and building off boot action. I think that favors Baker a lot more, and I think you're going to wind up seeing a quarterback with better numbers next year.
Teams like Cleveland have had a lot of reason to watch the national championship game because they might be drafting somebody coming out of it. What are you most looking forward to when Clemson and LSU go at it tonight?
Well, I want to see the two quarterbacks. I mean, you know, I know that's a bit hackneyed. I want to see the guy who's probably going to go number one this year in Joe Burrow, and the guy who's probably going to go number one next year in Trevor Lawrence. But, you know, I think that watching quarterbacks duel it out is always fun. The LSU defensive side of the ball, you know, here in Denver, I think are going to keep an eye on Christian Fulton. I don't think Grant Delpit's really a fifth year, but I'll be keeping an eye on him as well. So, you know, it's just looking for players, trying to identify players that can play in the National Football League and hoping to see a good football game.
I'm going to get you on before the draft, and we'll get more into it. But if you are sitting at number two and you're Washington right now, are you drafting a quarterback this year?
No, and I'm trying to trade, honestly. I'm hoping that I can convince Miami to come up to two for Tua, and then I'm moving back, multiplying picks. We have more holes than just a quarterback, more holes than just a Chase Young. So if I'm Washington, I'm looking to multiply draft picks, get a big old haul like the one that the Rams traded when they moved up for when the Rams got when they moved up for RG3, when Washington moved up for RG3. So I think I'd be looking to multiply my draft picks and hope to fill in all the holes that I've got for my new head coach, Ron Rivera.
And then just make sure you draft better than St. Louis did with what they got in return.
Very true. Very true.
That's part of the equation as well. Hey, Ben, great stuff as always. Love the follow on Twitter. Always appreciate the time you make for us here on this show. Thank you very much, and enjoy the national championship game tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. You guys as well.
That is Benjamin Albright out of Denver, NFL Insider. Great follow if you're an NFL fan. You've got to be following him. Has a lot of the scoops, especially when it comes to personnel on teams, guys that are moving into positions of power. He's all over the coaching stuff. At Albright, that's with two L's, NFL is the handle on Twitter. We're going to get back to talking hockey. Lots of your comments continue to pour in. We've talked so much about the Cassian and Tkachuk incident, and understandably so, that we haven't really dug into how tight the Pacific Division is. It's insane. 2 points separate first from fifth? That is nuts. Rick Ball joins me next. We'll get his opinion on what happened in the Battle of Alberta, plus everything going on with the Pacific Division movings and shakings right now. That's next on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
it's going to be one of those games where I know he's not going to fight, but maybe it's my turn to deliver something, follow him around a little and wait until he gets it in a bad situation.
That's the voice of Zach Kassian. Had plenty to say after the game. He's going to have to tell his tale to NHL player safety today. I'm Scott Rintoul. This is the Scott Rintoul Show. Rick Ball joins me here in just a couple minutes' time. Yes, that will be part of our conversation. We'll certainly get into that, get Rick's view on the subject. Matthew Tkachuk has spoken today. Flames are in Montreal, start of a road trip against the reeling Habs, who got an overtime win over Ottawa on the weekend, which was some sort of relief. But again, overtime against Ottawa, Kovalchuk scores the winner. It kind of tells you where that team is at right now. Matthew Tkachuk speaking to reporters today. Here's what he had to say about not fighting Zach Kassian on the weekend. It was probably the right thing to do there. If it was a different type of player out there, maybe. But it wasn't the right time to do it. I have a feeling half the people in the league wouldn't go with that guy. Obviously talking Kassian. Goes on to say this, I just think I'd rather be out there than in the box with him, and I'm sure if you ask my teammates, they'd rather me out there. Then he was asked about the possibility of a suspension for Zach Kassian. He said this, it's not my call. I'm happy I don't have to make those decisions. Those guys have a really tough job. Your feedback continues to pour in on this subject. Scott, I think the real problem here is the fact the NHL came out and said there was nothing wrong with those hits in an era where concussions are a real problem. They need to give their heads a shake. It's time to protect players against kids that compromise their safety. That's Christopher, who is stuck in traffic. To reset, if I were governing that game, I would have handed out a penalty on the wraparound where Tkachuk blasts Kassian, where Kassian is trying to score on the wraparound. That's the one where I would have given a penalty. I think there's head contact there. Now, the referees didn't think there was. They didn't think it was a principal point of contact. The league has said, listen, we're fine with it too. We didn't have any problem with those hits. We're not calling Matthew Tkachuk. We're good with them. There are a lot of ex-NHLers weighing in saying, I've got a big problem with the hit. You know what you're doing. You're a winger coming down. That's not a place a player expects to get hit, let alone multiple times in the course of the same game. I understand the other side as well. Hey, if the league deems it legal, why shouldn't Matthew Tkachuk deliver those hits? Kevin sends in this. Was there a concussion protocol called? I don't think so. The ref felt they were okay. The league felt they were okay. And did he target the Stars? No, he targeted the biggest guy on the team. Does he have to fight because Zach Kassian didn't like it? And I've made my point on that clear as well. I've never been a believer that if you throw a clean hit, and again, I'm differentiating between the two, the hit that ultimately causes Zach Kassian to throw down his gloves, throw down Tkachuk, and start wailing away, that's the hit I have less of a problem with. By that point, it's the accumulation of the hits. That's the third hit on the night. It's the second that's kind of like the one that I ultimately think should have been a penalty in the second period, or probably in the first period. And so at that point, Kassian is losing it. I've never been a believer that if you throw a clean hit, you should have to fight. Not a believer in that. I understand it's tradition. I understand that if you throw a certain amount of hits, tradition dictates, code dictates, well, it's time for you to throw down your gloves. Part of it has to do with circumstance as well. And this is where Tkachuk wins the argument. He doesn't fight. His team gets the power play. They win the game, which to him is more important. Now, Dave Tippett after the game kind of gave a mixed review on the subject. The old school coach in Dave Tippett, the guy who's been around the game forever, basically said, I get it. I get it. But he also went on to say, you know, you'd prefer you take a number there and maybe deal with it later. We're in a 3-3 hockey game at the time, and that's the balance you're trying to strike. And that's why Matt Tkachuk kind of wins. Not only does he get the hit, he draws the penalty, his team scores on the power play, they win the game. And that is part of what makes him such an effective player, that he can get under the skin of the opposition and that he can hurt you on the scoreboard and his teammates can hurt you on the scoreboard. It's part of what makes him so effective. It's not as though he has never fought in his career. There are a lot of people who would like to have seen him fight more than he has, but he has thrown down the gloves, as some of our listeners have pointed out this morning. On the question of charging, should either of those hits been called charging? Hoggs sends in this. You start going down a slippery slope with the calling of a charge every time a D-man goes back for a puck and a forward's racing in from center on him. Will you then have to call those? I mentioned this earlier. It's such a discretionary call. There's no hard and fast rule, how many strides it is. Difficult for officials to pick that up in the moment anyway. They can't tell right then, well, where did that guy start from? Where did he start tracking a player from? How far away did he come? They just have to make a call. Did the guy come from far enough away? It's a feel thing. Kachuk's got a real chance as a politician. That's from Okanagan Jay. That's good. I like that today. Keep those texts coming in. You've got the Fed feedback line. You've got the text message inbox. Get in with the conversation. Rob says the NHL has already said they have no problem with Kachuk's hits. Cassian gave the Flames the game. We'll continue to have this conversation. I'm sure it's going on around the hockey world today. And Matthew Kachuk was asked about it. He didn't shy away from the conversation. Rick Ball, he has seen most, if not all, of Matthew Kachuk's game since he arrived in the National Hockey League. He joins us now. He of Hockey Night in Canada, Sportsnet Play-by-Play. Baller, how you doing on this Monday?
Scotty, I am great, man. I mean, this. I couldn't be more excited because Prince Harry and Meghan are apparently moving to Canada, and I am over the moon.
Are you trying to sell them on any potential real estate opportunities?
I'm in Montreal, and I get to call the Flames and the Canadiens in Montreal in one of the great arenas in all of sport tonight, and that's always exciting. So I'm looking forward to that.
And yet everybody's talking about what happened Saturday. You know that. You understand that.
Yep.
Rick, what, if anything, didn't you like in the series of hits by Kachuk on Cassian?
I agree with what you were saying. I think the first one was a little more borderline than the second one, but I think Cassian was more embarrassed than anything, especially, you know, being the kind of player that he is. And he just felt like he had to do something about what Kachuk was clearly doing, which was going after him physically. And Kachuk didn't bite. They wind up getting a power play and scoring the game-winning goal. But as a bigger issue, and I was talking to a guy today who played nearly 800 games in the NHL as a defenseman at the morning skate over at Bell Center. And he was saying, whatever happened to guys having their heads on a swivel when they have the puck? He said, nobody throws hits anymore, so players don't pay attention to that possibility as much as they used to. And he was saying, when I used to play, I always knew who was on the ice, especially when the guy already drilled me once earlier in a game and was, like I said, had my head on a swivel. So that's from a guy who played a ton of National Hockey League games as a defenseman. So I thought that was an interesting observation. I know there have been other people out on social media, former players, saying that those are the kinds of hits that the NHL is trying to get away from. My personal feeling, and this has less to do with what specifically happened on Saturday, and more just generally in the NHL, and I understand that the knowledge about head trauma is a lot better than it used to be, and I maybe come across as a knuckle-dragger or a Neanderthal when I say this, but I'm glad that they're maybe letting more hitting get back into the game. It's a contact sport. And what bothers me is whenever there's a big hit made, we all go back over the video, slow it down as much as we possibly can, and try and look for evidence of head contact or was it clean or was it dirty. And this sort of over, my feeling anyway, this an overanalysis of every big body check that happens now in the sport of hockey is taking away, from my perspective, one of the great things about the sport, which is the bravery it takes to play it at the highest level, because there is an element of danger. Again, there's a line, for sure. But there was a time, you know, we're talking about the Battle of Alberta. You go back to the 80s, those games were unbelievably intense and physical. And people loved it. The fans loved it. The players loved it. You know, and to get a little bit of that back into a game between the Oilers and the Flames on a weekend, I didn't have a big problem with it. Now, you know, I can understand why Zach Cassian was mad, and I could see from an Oilers perspective you not being happy with, certainly with the first hit that Kachuk threw. But in a general sense, I'm all for more physical play in the NHL. Again, within the context of understanding the issue of head trauma, I totally get it. But, you know, I'm happier when the games are more physical than less physical. Let me put it that way.
Well, and I think we're going to get that same endorsement from the NHL when it rules on this Zach Kassian hearing. I think they're going to give him 1 to 2 games, Rick, which to me is, hey, we don't like the optics of you swinging at a guy who's helmetless down on the ice when he is not engaged in the fight. We can't have that. But we also know that what happened on Saturday, up to an extent, is really good for our game. It drives interest, and we want you playing in that game on January 29th. Don't you get that same feeling?
Yeah, I don't know that that's going to be the logic, is that we want Kassian back for the rematch in terms of what they might hand out in the form of a suspension. But, listen, and especially you got a guy like George Parros, who is, you know, running their disciplinary department. You know, that guy was a tough fighter who played the game at extremely physically. Now, granted, different era for sure, but I guarantee you he understands how important having a physical element to the sport is. And too many games that you see nowadays don't have that anymore. So to complain about it when it happens, I think is probably to the detriment of the overall entertainment level of the product. I mean, if you want the league to get away from having any physical contact whatsoever, you're going to wind up with a lot of games that had zero intensity, and it's just not the same. Again, maybe I'm an old schooler and a knuckle dragger, and I don't want it to go back to the days where guys are getting their head taken off on a regular basis, but the fact that that game had some emotion and some contact involved in it, to me, made it that much more fun to watch. It was a terrific hockey game. I mean, that's one of the best games I've seen this season involving any two teams, and part of the reason why is that there was a level of intensity there that we don't get often enough.
Well, and it sets up so well for January 29th and then early February as well. These two teams are going to play in really short order, and while we can all, you know, look for little things about scheduling these days and the way the NHL sets it up that bug us, I'll tell you, it works right now that these two teams are going to play again in the next 3 weeks. It's fantastic.
And they see each other on the last weekend of the season, if I'm not mistaken, as well. You know, it's funny, there was I can't remember when this was, but it was fairly recently where the Flames and the Oilers have played all of their games before the end of January. And people were like, what's going on? And then people were complaining this year that their first game didn't come until after Christmas. But I'd rather have it this way, especially with how tight the race is in the Pacific Division right now, for them to be seeing a lot of each other in the second half of the season. And the fact that they've got a bunch of games crammed into a couple weeks span is even more interesting. So I agree, this is terrific, and I love it. I mean, I've been wanting the Battle of Alberta to come back, you know, ever since I've been in Calgary. This is my sixth year now doing Calgary Flames television broadcasts, and the two teams haven't been sort of neck and neck in the standings since I've been here, and the Oilers have been bad except for the 1 year when they had that great season and Cam Talbot was terrific for them in goal and they got into the playoffs. But other than that, they've kind of been out of the running. The Flames have been up and down. They've been better more than the Oilers have, but you know, to get a game with that level of importance involving the two teams in the province of Alberta and have it pan out the way that it did just sets up for even better games down the stretch. And I don't think any fan in either city is going to be complaining about that.
In conversation with Rick Ball, play-by-play voice for Hockey Night in Canada and Sportsnet this morning on the Scott Rintoul Show. You mentioned the Pacific Division. It's insane that only 2 points separate first from fifth right now. Can you make any sense of what the race has become here nearly 50 games into the season?
Well, other than the teams are all very similar in terms of success, that's really, I don't know why it's been, why it's like that right now, except you've got five teams battling for three spots in the division, and then, of course, the two wild card spots in the Western Conference. I think it's great. It's fantastic that three of them are Canadian teams as well. This is one of the tightest races I can remember for at least the last decade in terms of the divisional battle for first place. And like I said about the games involving Calgary and Edmonton being so intense, I don't think anybody's complaining about the battle within the division. And, you know, you look like the Flames are talking. Jeff Ward was talking about it today, and so was Mark Giordano. But they don't play again after the game today in Montreal. The Flames don't play again until Thursday. So all those teams that are bunched together are going to have games in between those on the off days for Calgary. So it's so critical to get points when you get a chance to get them, because if you sit for a couple days, you may go from first to fifth in the blink of an eye. And that could realistically happen if the Flames aren't able to win tonight in Montreal. It just puts that much more on every single game when the teams around you are all winning and the race is that tight, and it makes for better hockey. So it's been quite a battle so far in the Pacific Division. I really don't see it changing. I see this division going right down to the wire, and that's good for everybody involved.
When you look at Edmonton, Calgary, and Vancouver specifically, does one of those markets have any more pressure than the other two as far as making the playoffs go this year?
That's a really good question. I just think the Oilers probably, because, you know, it's been such a struggle, and, you know, they made some changes this year. They changed their coach. They, you know, Ken Holland's the general manager there now. They still have perhaps the best player in the entire National Hockey League. I think he is, and Connor McDavid. So, you know, they've got a lot of pieces in place, and it's been such a dry spell, say, for that one season, that that's a team that people keep expecting to finally get it turned around. And how long can they keep going and missing, you know, with McDavid and making changes, another coaching change, like I said. So the pressure is probably more there, but you look in Calgary, that's a team last year that had the best record in the entire Western Conference and then flamed out, no pun intended, in the first round of the playoffs. So, you know, and then had a whole bunch of drama surrounding their coaching situation this year for reasons that were outside of the team's control, obviously. But the expectations for the Flames coming into this year were very high, so perhaps there's pressure on them as well. The least pressure, I don't want to say the least pressure, because there's pressure in every market, certainly in Canada, to at least get into the playoffs. But I look at the Vancouver Canucks as a team that's making the natural progression year after year after year. So, you know, it'd be great to see the Canucks in the playoffs this season, but the fact they're making improvements is encouraging for Vancouver fans, because they're building towards something. They're not behind schedule for sure, and they've got so many great young players that the future is extremely bright. So out of those three teams, to me, the one that has the least pressure on it, again, not none, but the least of the three would be the Vancouver Canucks. And to me, the future for the Canucks is bright, but they still have a ways to go in terms of their overall arc as a franchise, where I think the pressure in Calgary because of last season and Edmonton because they've had so many dry years is higher.
Not going to ask you for any particular insight into Ray Shero losing his job in New Jersey. I know you're not around that team and don't know exactly why that decision was made, but the philosophy in general to let go of a GM partway through the season, it's not traditional for a lot of people. Some people wonder why. Rick, I actually think timing-wise, if you're going to move on from a general manager, halfway through the NHL season or just before that isn't the worst time, because the person who's going to control your trade deadline and your draft should be the new guy going down the road, shouldn't it?
That makes sense. I was thinking the same thing. Again, I don't know the circumstances. I'm pretty far away from that whole situation, but, you know, they're having a tough year, obviously. They're, what, 5 or 6 games under 500 near the bottom of the league. So, you know, it's not shocking other than the timing. And if you're going to do it with trade deadline now 6 weeks away, the new guy is going to be able to step in and at least have a chance to get a better assessment of his team and do what he might want to do before the deadline with a good understanding, as opposed to having a guy in that seat, you know, lame duck GM who you might fire at the end of the season, make a bunch of moves at the end of February, and then hand it off to the new guy who takes over in the off season. So, you know, on that level, it probably does make some sense. I don't know that it's going to help much this year, but going forward for a new general manager, probably a better situation that he's had a chance to go through a trade deadline and not have to deal with whatever decisions the guy that he replaces made before the deadline. So, yeah, on some level, it probably makes sense, but it is unusual to see a GM fired midseason for sure.
As you mentioned off the top, you're in Montreal. Flames and Canadiens go today. Listen, when you're in a Canadian market, there's always talk and there's always navel-gazing. But when you get to Montreal, does it feel like a different level?
Yeah, and you get it in two different languages here too, right? You've got the French media and the English media, so there's so much focus on the Montreal Canadiens. I mean, you know, one of the original six franchises. It's a great hockey city, my favorite rink in the entire league. As an aside, every time I sit in the stands for a skate in the morning in Montreal, I think to myself, they got it so right. The way they built that arena, I don't know if you had a chance, Scotty, to watch a game at Bell Center in the stands, but the pitch of the seating is so steep that you can be 20 rows up and you feel like you're right on top of the ice. So many of these rinks you go into now, especially even the newer ones, the slope is so shallow, you're a mile back from the ice surface. Montreal is like almost straight up and down. It feels like it. It feels like if you trip on a step, you're going to stop rolling sometime in June. But in terms of sight lines, it's the best in the entire National Hockey League. The new rink in Detroit might be close second, and they model a lot of what they did there after the Bell Center. So that's a long way of saying, for me, with the new arena coming in Calgary, I hope that they to take a lot of notes out of the building here in Montreal, because it's a hockey rink first, and there's no better place to watch a game. So getting back to your point, I love calling games in Montreal. The Habs just snapped an 8-game losing skid, so of course the sky is falling here, although they did get a win on the weekend in Ottawa. So obviously everybody's setting their hair on fire, but it's been a tough season for Montreal. And, you know, they're not totally out of it yet, but boy, it's going to be hard for them to rally with, you know, they have 45 points. So right now they're 8 points out of a play out of that second wild card spot, with what, 5 teams between them and Florida, which sits in eighth place. That's a tough task, but the St. Louis Blues, this is going to be the go-to for every team from now until the end of time. The St. Louis Blues were dead last and they came back and won the Stanley Cup. So I guess anything is possible, but it seems to me with the Canadiens, it's a bit of a long shot this year. However, with Carey Price, you never know. He can get on a red-hot roll, and this team can go on a long run if he finds his A game, which he hasn't had much of this year. So we'll see how it plays out. But, you know, it's always fun to come to Montreal, whether they're winning or losing. Doesn't matter to me. I love being in this town to watch hockey.
You're right about the Blues. They are to the NHL with the 0-5 BC Lions in 2011 are to the CFL. They're always that glimmer of hope that you can roll and go, well, they did it. Why not us? Last thing before I let you go, you're in Montreal. Will there be smoked meat on the horizon for you, sir?
I will say that I did have a smoked meat sandwich last night. I was planning on ordering, because I wanted to watch the football game, watch the Seahawks and the Packers, so I was going to order room service, but staying in a pretty expensive hotel, I looked at the menu and a hamburger was $41. Forget that. So I went outside. It was cool. I forgot to bring a toque with me, but it didn't matter. I walked 3 blocks and got myself a smoked meat sandwich from Dunn's, and I enjoyed it very much.
Good for you. And not going with the $41 hamburger. Baller, have a great call of the game. Thanks for doing this. Look forward to chatting in a couple weeks' time.
My pleasure, Scotty. Take care.
That is Rick Ball in Montreal. He's absolutely right. They got it 100% right. That is the template for any NHL team when you look at the way they built the arena, the way they lit that arena, with the way they do their game presentation. It is so great to go there. You don't have to be a Habs fan. If you're in Montreal, you have a chance to go to a hockey game, and you are a sports fan, let alone a hockey fan, make the investment. Go to the game. You will not regret it for a second, regardless of how the game plays out that night. It's just an experience that you got to go through. You're in Chicago, you got to go to Wrigley Field. You're in Boston, you got to go to Fenway. You're in Montreal, you have to go to the Bell Center and check out a game there. These first 2 hours, they zip by with all the NFL football, the Cassie and Kachuk, the hockey, the 2 points separating first from fifth in Pacific Division. We'll dig into that more tomorrow. We'll send you to Hockey Central in Calgary. Now, here in Vancouver, we'll get a little more into what happened for the Canucks over the course of the week and the Seahawks as well. Dan Murphy will join me from the road in Winnipeg. This is the Scott Rintoul Show.
This is the Scott Rintoul Show.
Besser shoots and scores right off the draw.
First career NHL goal, Quinn Hughes.
On the official home of the Canucks.
And it's Markstrom again, this time with the glove.
Elias Pettersson, and shoots, scores!
Sportsnet 650.
What's up? Get that Subway text box going, 650, 650. If you want in on the Canucks weekend, if you want in on Cassian v. Kachuk, get in on that as well. We will also talk some NFL playoffs this segment. We'll talk about the Seahawks, what went down or what didn't go down. Russell Wilson not with the ball in his hands when that game ended last night. Who's to blame for that? Was it simply too big of a hole? But what news that just came down here in recent minutes? Chris Wall, you may have heard on the update, giving you the announcement about the Houston Astros. Massive, massive penalties for sign stealing. This is a big deal in baseball. The Red Sox are under investigation right now, and the Red Sox better hope they don't have the kind of evidence they had against the Houston Astros. Now, remember, this is a franchise that has been running afoul in a few regards. Everything that happened with the controversy leading up to the World Series. You remember that? You remember the assistant GM at the time going down and shouting things about Roberto Osuna to some female reporters and then denying it ever happened and pretending that they were talking about something else, and then eventually that guy loses his job, and Major League Baseball says, you can't be doing this, not on our watch. Houston, great team. They've got themselves a World Series. They came close to getting another one this year, but it doesn't sound like they've been doing it all above board. So Major League Baseball finds, yes, you've been sign-stealing. Here's what's happening to them. A one-year suspension for the general manager, Jeff Luhnow, and a one-year suspension to the manager, A.J. Hinch. They have lost their first and second-round draft picks for this year and next year. They've also been fined $5 million. Major League Baseball did not take this lightly whatsoever. This is a massive penalty that has been handed down to the Houston Astros. And good on Major League Baseball for taking a strong stand here. Now, I'll bet you there's some other nervous franchises around the league right now. You can't tell me the Astros were the only team doing this in isolation. As mentioned, you've got the Boston Red Sox under investigation. But this is a massive penalty that has been handed down by Major League Baseball. A year for both the GM and the manager. Loss of first and second round picks, and in baseball it's a little bit different because those picks don't get handed out all the time. Yankees fan extraordinaire Randy Janda is fist pumping right now. Astros, the team that vanquished the poor New York Yankees and all their riches during the course of this past postseason. $5 million fine. Not good times down in Houston. As good as that baseball team has been, not good times down in Houston over the last little while. Didn't come on here to talk baseball. We'll talk plenty of hockey. We'll talk plenty of football as well here this morning. As mentioned, get your text in. Subway text line is 650-650. Live on location today, by the way, out in Ladner. We are at Dunbar Lumber, and here's the reason we're on hand. Not only is Ken Priestley a good guy and said, hey, why don't you come by and do the show sometime? Sure, we can do that. But raising money for a very, very worthwhile cause. A lot of you know how big, expansive the Canucks Autism Network has become, and what a great fundraising initiative it is to help so many families who find themselves or a member of their family on the spectrum. We are raising donations for Canucks Autism Network Pro-Am here today. The Pro-Am involves ex-NHL players, ex-Canucks, I should say, that take part with some rec teams during the course of their tournament that'll go later this month. You come down here. If you're stopping by Dunbar Lumber to pick up some supplies, that's where the contractors come. You need something for home rentals as well. Come here, pick it up. You can donate to the Canucks Autism Network Pro-Am. If you just want to have lunch, if you don't need anything for your house in terms of rentals, but you want to have lunch, Triple O's, we've got the truck here. It's on location. And for every combo sold, $5 goes to the Canucks Autism Network Pro-Am. We're at Bridge Street in Ladner, 4989 Bridge Street, to be precise. If you don't know where that is, just plug it into the old GPS and you will get here. The road's not that bad. I made my way here from North Van today. I was cruising in the cushy Volvo XC90, so I had peace of mind the entire time. But the road's in very good condition. Make your way here. Come see us. Stop by and donate to a very worthwhile cause. The Canucks cause, pretty worthwhile over the course of the weekend. This market, not unlike others in Western Canada, not unlike others in this country, team goes on a little streak in the wrong direction. And for the Canucks, that amounted to two games. I'm always amazed at how quickly perspective is lost. You win seven straight games. So even after you've lost two, guess what? You've still won 7 of 9. But people are caught up in the recent games, and they were blowouts. And where are the Canucks? And maybe they should have lost a bunch of games during their winning streak. They don't deserve to be where they're at right now. And then what do? They go out and pick up back-to-back wins on the weekend. Win in Buffalo, put up 6, go to Minnesota. Not the most entertaining game. It was a power play fest for the first part, and nobody was able to connect on the power play until Elias Pettersson finally got that goal to go in. Nice deflection by him. Quinn Hughes, big weekend for him. Gets an assist in each game after being named to the All-Star game. I love some of the comments coming out from Quinn Hughes, by the way. That it's not just that he had the success offensively, which we all expected, and he expected as well. But him saying he has been so impressed and felt so good about the fact that Canucks have entrusted him to be in a more defensive role at times, to shut teams down at times, to be out there when top lines are out. That, to him, has really instilled a sense of confidence and told him what a remarkable season it has been to this point in time. But back to the Canucks. They put up 10 goals in the weekend. They get themselves a couple of wins. Markstrom starts back-to-back games, which I didn't see coming, and I don't really have an issue with. So long as Demko starts tomorrow night, that's what I would do. Now, I have said before, and I will always revert to this, we're at a point with Canucks goaltending where Travis Green can't really make a bad decision, can he? It's always easy to second guess if the goaltender doesn't play spectacularly or the Canucks lose the game. Well, they should have gone with the other guy. You saw Jacob Markstrom was rolling. He'd won 6 of the 7 games on the 7-game win streak. They go into Tampa Bay to take on another team that had won 7 straight, and there was nobody out there calling for Thatcher Demko to start that game. But the second the Canucks lose it, I don't know what Green's doing. He should have started Demko. No. That's revisionist history. Don't go hindsight on me here. Have a take coming in and stick to it. I'm at the point where you can't really quibble with the goaltending decisions. You can't, because both guys have played very well. And Markstrom has been spectacular enough that you find him going to the All-Star game this year, on the verge of signing a new deal, trying to figure out what that's going to look like. So if they want to play Jacob Markstrom back-to-back games on the weekend, that's fine. I do think he needs some rest at some point. I came into this road trip thinking the Canucks need to play Demko twice. It still sets up for them to do that. I think it's the smart play to go with Demko tomorrow night in Winnipeg. And here is the short-term situation you could fall into, and I think it's the wrong way to approach it. I don't think the Canucks are approaching it this way. Look, if they go with Markstrom tomorrow, I'm not going to second-guess them. Not going to. But I would like Demko to play for this reason. You're still thinking big-picture perspective. Where are they in the standings right now? They're sitting a point out of first place. And they've got games in hand on everybody. I don't know where you ultimately think Vancouver shakes out in the Pacific Division mix, but they're right there, and the math tells you they are going to be there until late March, barring an unprecedented collapse, and it doesn't feel like that's coming for this team. So this is about big picture. This is about having Jacob Markstrom ready and raring to go in late March, when the games are bigger. Bigger than they are going to be tomorrow in Winnipeg. I know the Jets are in and around you, competing for a wild card spot in the standings. I get that. That's fine. But you know where the bigger games lie? March, April, and he needs to be fresh and ready for those. There's a pretty big game coming on Thursday, in fact. I know the Jets are in the wild card conversation with the Canucks. The Canucks haven't played Arizona yet. Arizona picked up a point in a shootout loss to Pittsburgh yesterday. That's why they find themselves one up on Vancouver, despite the Canucks having 2 games in hand. Arizona and Calgary tied atop the division. If it's me, I want Jacob Markstrom raring and ready to go for Thursday. So it makes sense to play Thatcher Demko tomorrow in Winnipeg to me. Again, it's not a freak out, what are you doing move if Markstrom plays, but that's what I would do. I wanted Demko to play 2 games in this road trip. Is the most positive sign of it Brock Besser getting his groove back as far as goal scoring goes? The points have been there all season. He's made some excellent passes, and from a point accumulation standpoint, hasn't been an issue for Brock Besser. But the fact that he got back to scoring goals, and the goal that he scored, the second one against Buffalo, that's the one you feel the best about, isn't it? It really is. With all due respect to the other two, the one he gets against Florida early in the game and the first one he scores against Buffalo, those are good. Those are deflections in the right spot, going to the right areas, getting your stick on it. Those all count too. And goal scorers score those. But getting Brock Besser back into that slot, quick shot away, good release, that's where Brock Besser starts to get back into his groove a little bit. That's the guy we came to know over the course of that 29-goal rookie campaign. That's the guy who we saw in spurts last year, though he never felt like he was really in rhythm. That's a Brock Besser goal. It would have been great to see him score yesterday, and Ian McIntyre did a phenomenal job with the piece yesterday leading up to the game, talking about Brock Besser having a chance to go home to Minnesota where his dad was able to come to a game. If you've been following Besser, and I know most of you have, you know the struggles his family has been through with his dad's health, and that it was really touch and go, and they didn't know what was going to amount, that this one was going to amount to. The fact that his dad was able to go to that game, yeah, it would have been great to see him score. Just great for the Canucks to get a win. Great for 70 to 80 people who are either family or very close friends of the Besser family to be there cheering on Besser. And for him to just have an opportunity to see his family again was a great story. And that great story was made even better by the fact that he started to get a couple. Horvat gets some puck luck on the weekend. He didn't get snipes from Bo Horvat, but he got goals. And some of that is puck luck coming back. There's been a lot made, certainly early in the year, about Bo Horvat's offense and where is it. And some of that comes back to puck luck. He gets three goals over the course of the weekend as well. Canucks get a couple of wins. Where are you at right now when you look at the Pacific Division? Where do you look at the Vancouver Canucks? Do you say, hey, man, we're almost 50 games in. I know they weren't supposed to be the team that wins it, but it's anybody's game. Where are you at on that conversation right now? Certainly, we're going to kick around a lot of this on Canucks Central today. Dan Riccio, Randeep Janna, they're going to join me live here on location. We're at Dunbar Lumber. Ladner, come see us, 4989 Bridge Street. We're going to do Canucks Central from here today, and we'll have that conversation, get their takes on what they saw over the course of the weekend. You want to text in? Subway text line is 650-650. We've had a lot of feedback on this. Zach Kassian, Matthew Tkachuk. I'm going to get to the NFL playoffs in just a second because we're going to talk a lot of hockey with Dan Murphy at the bottom of the hour. But I do want to reset where I'm at with Kassian, Tkachuk. I didn't like the first hit. And by first hit, I know there's three overall. It's the last two I'm talking about here. So when I say first hit, I'm talking about Zach Kassian wrapping around the net in the first period, trying to score, and Tkachuk labeling him. I think there was head contact there. That's my view of it. I saw a guy who was just going to light a player up, and I think he got head. That's what I think. Now, there's some other people. No, not like that, Raja. There's some other people who think it was clean, and those people happen to be governing the league. The NHL said, we don't have a problem with the hit. The referee's on scene now. We don't have a problem with it. But we all know if the referees call a penalty there, what happens in the second period doesn't end up happening. I understand why Kassian was incensed. I had less problem with the final hit than I did with the second one that I just described, albeit in clippable fashion for a lot of the guys who are cutting audio back at the station. I didn't have a problem with the final hit as much. I understand, and I have read from the likes of Solani and Upshaw and a bunch of guys who played the game, hey, that's a predatory hit to a certain degree. Wingers don't come down like that. Guys aren't expecting that hit. I understand why they said that. I understand why that last one is a sneaky, dirty hit. I feel like the second one, the one I've been calling the first one, on the wraparound, that's the one I want gone. I don't want that hit. The last one I can live with. The last one, shoulder to shoulder. Now, I know why Kassian snaps. I get it. No penalty's been called. He's been railroaded three different times in the game. The last two being pretty big ones, dislodging his helmet. He's got to stop himself, though. The second that Tkachuk isn't willing to throw down, the second he can tell Tkachuk just isn't going to play that game, whether he thinks it's a little kitten move or not, as he described it after the game, he's got to stop. That's it. And that's why I think he's going to get a 1-2 game suspension. But the hit itself, if we're talking in a vacuum and we're talking about the final hit, I can live with that hit in the game. And I don't think Matthew Tkachuk should have to fight after just that hit. I understand with the accumulation why people are making the case Tkachuk should have to hit. My problem with it has always been this. You're playing a game where there are legal forms of assault. You have so many different ways to get back at him within the rules of the game. Okay, he doesn't want to fight you there. Guess what? I'm going to come after you in the third period. Or better yet, because this is what would really get a player like that's attention. I'm going to go hit Johnny Gaudreau. I'm going to go smoke Johnny Gaudreau. That's what's going to happen. Or another one of my teammates is going to do that. Because the message we will send then is, okay, if you don't want to take care of your own business in the time-honored tradition, we got other ways to do it. And that's how we're going to go about it. That's always been my problem with legal hit gets delivered, but it's a big hit and somebody doesn't like it and we got to fight now. No, you don't. No, you don't. You don't see it in other sports that way. In other sports, they take a number or they say, oh, we'll see you in the third quarter. In the third quarter, you're going to have to come across the middle again. Or, hey, you lit our guy up. Cool. We're going to have an opportunity to go after you on a blocking play. That's what we're going to do. But you don't see them decide they've got to fight. Retribution in that moment. There seems to be an understanding of the physical nature of the game and the chance that something else is going to happen later in the game and you're going to have an opportunity to control that. Had a lot of people weighing in on this. The only reason the second hit was called as head contact is because it was Cassian that got, or wasn't called, pardon me. Here's the text that comes in. The only reason the second hit wasn't called as head contact was because it was Cassian that got hit. If it was any other player on the Oilers team, they get a shoulder to the head, their helmet flies off, it would have been a penalty. I don't know if any other player qualifies. I can say this. If Matthew Tkachuk had lit up McDavid like that and his helmet comes off, there's a penalty for sure, and there's probably discipline coming. I'll agree with that. I won't say any other player. There does exist this clause within the code, if you will, that if you're a physical player, you also have to endure more. Well, you hit people, so people can hit you more. There is a part of that. Officials govern the game that way. As for the Matthew Tkachuk side of things, you can talk about honor. You can talk about the code. Pretty tough to argue he didn't do the right thing. It's on the officials to call the penalty. If they don't call it, and they let the first one go, and they let the second one go, and now he's engaged with a guy who wants to fight, you can say, hey, the honorable thing to do is for you to throw down your gloves and fight him. But he did the right thing, didn't he? Got Cassian sent to the box for 4 minutes and a misconduct. His team scored the game-winning goal on the power play, and he rattled the opposition. That's part of what makes Matthew Tkachuk so effective. It's part of why it drives Canucks fans nuts that he wasn't drafted here. That's part of the reason, because he's so damn good at that. I had some people say that they see him as a Matt Cook. I don't think he's there. I think that Matthew Tkachuk engages in hits, lines things up in a way that is at times sneaky dirty, and sometimes he crosses the line. But I don't think he's as far down the road as Matt Cook ever got to. Jordan from Saskatoon. Tkachuk got what he deserved. He plays on that fringe between clean and dirty plays. Cassian had just had enough of his crap. Tkachuk knows what he's doing. So to be surprised that Cassian reacted the way he did, I don't blame him. But watching him ragdoll Tkachuk was awesome. I bet the next time they play, Tkachuk isn't going to be taking the liberties he took in that game. That's why he gets under Doughty's skin, because he doesn't do anything about it. It's like standing up to the bully on the playground. I think you're wrong in this sense, Jordan. I think based on the way that game unfolded, why wouldn't Matthew Tkachuk do the exact same thing next game? You explain to me why he wouldn't. His team got the win. He didn't get penalized. The other guy's going for a disciplinary hearing. Why wouldn't he go about it the exact same way? This one comes in unsigned. I think retribution on the hit is absolutely ridiculous. If it's a good, solid, legal hit, that's part of the game. Therefore, if someone scores a nice goal, logic would say, hey, you need to fight now. Logic doesn't dictate that. I understand what you're saying. Keep those comments coming. I'll ask Dan Murphy his opinion on this as well when he joins me at the bottom of the hour. I do want to turn our attention to the NFL playoffs. Shocker, the weekend obviously goes down in Baltimore, but let's start with the team that most of you follow most closely, the Seattle Seahawks. Just dug himself too big of a hole. And this is part of the risk you run when you play in all of these one-score games and you decide you are going to run the ball first and foremost, whether it sets up that way or not, and you allow a hole to be dug. Sometimes that hole gets too big. And we've seen this in playoffs past with different incarnations and certainly a different version of Marshawn Lynch at the time than the one we've been watching the last few weeks. We saw the Seahawks do this in Russell Wilson's rookie campaign. They got down big to Atlanta. Almost came back and won that game. Took a last-minute Matt Ryan drive for a field goal for the Falcons to get over in Russell Wilson's first trip to the second round of the playoffs. But they just dug too big of a hole. We saw it again against Carolina in what looked like it was going to be a blowout loss in 2016. And Russell Wilson did what he almost did yesterday. He almost brought the Seahawks back. 21-3 was just too much. It was pretty clear early in that game, Marshawn Lynch was not going to be able to run the ball. As much as we like the story, as great as his career was, his legacy will be indelible with that franchise. But he's not the same guy. He can't run the ball. He certainly can't do it in volume. He can score touchdowns for you. He can pound out short yardage for you. But Marshawn Lynch, it was early it was indicated very early he wasn't going to be a difference maker, that he wasn't going to be capable of being a difference maker in that game, at least as far as volume goes. But they kept beating their heads against the wall a little bit. And Russell Wilson just a little bit off in that first half. And the next thing you know, they're down 21-3. Now, Wilson brings them back, and he brings them almost all the way back. They only lose by 5 points, and there are a lot of Seahawks fans that feel if they would have gotten the ball back one more time, Russell gets the job done. And I understand exactly why you feel that way. But what killed this team in the late stages of that game in the fourth quarter is exactly what has killed this team at other times this year. Their defense just isn't good enough, and they couldn't get off the field on third down. You can blame the offense if you want, but Russell Wilson gets almost as much out of that as anybody could ever expect, and more. They couldn't get off the field on third down. You got 3rd and 9. What was the Jimmy Graham play? 3rd and 8? Get off the field just once. And they couldn't do it. And Aaron Rodgers never gave the ball back, and that was it. And I've seen some make the case, listen, they should never have punted it back. With 2:41 left in that game, don't give the ball back. Or 2:55, whatever it was when that punt went off. They were 4th and 11 on their own 36. Sorry, you're not going for it on 4th down there. That's a desperation move. At some point, whether you think it's the strength of your team or not, you got to believe in your defense. Pete Carroll did. Defense let him down. Devontae Adams was sensational. Rodgers made plays when he had to. And Green Bay, much like Seattle, while not terribly impressive, gets the result it needs. Now heads to San Fran. Brock Huard, he's a staple on Monday mornings, on our morning show, the starting lineup, with James Cebulski and Perry Solkowski. He had this to say about the Seahawks moving forward after this loss.
Unlike the last two off-seasons where you felt a bit stuck, and last year they got unstuck by making an un-Seahawk-like move and trading Frank Clark, a young player off his first contract where, you know, for a decade they had paid those guys. So they were able to, and you know, I think, be creative and get a little bit unstuck. This is an off-season with, what, $50 to $60 million of cap space? This is an off-season with 11 draft picks, including 2 first-rounders. I mean, this is the off-season that you're really built, I think, to replenish this roster with more top-end talent, more elite players that they need. That includes, in my opinion, having to sign Jadeveon Clowney. Ione Bambi was a first-team All-Pro and had a bunch of tackles, but the most impactful players for the Seahawks this year on the field were Russell Wilson 1 and Clowney 2. And that's got to be, I think, first and top priority. I hope they can get that done before he ever has to go to the free agent market, where it could even get wackier, you know, financially as far as what they owe him. But no, I think that this is much more of a season to build on, just my feeling, than the last two have been because of the resources available to you this offseason.
Good points made by Brock Huard. And this team, while Seahawks fans don't want to hear it right now, this team overachieved this year based on the defense they were able to roll out there. The injury struck them at the wrong time, and maybe it was set up better for them given the way the NFC shook down. If you have a healthy Chris Carson, maybe we're having a different conversation here today. I just never watched that Seahawks team and had ultimate confidence in that defense. It's what gets the San Francisco 49ers to where they're at hosting this game and why they're the favorite against Green Bay, because of the backbone of that defense. Come see us. We're live on location today doing the show. In fact, Sportsnet 650 is here till 4 o'clock this afternoon. We are at Bridge Street in Ladner, 4989 Bridge Street in Ladner. We're at Dunbar Lumber. We're collecting donations for the Canucks Autism Network Pro-Am. Triple O's is on site. Come down, have lunch, grab a combo. $5 from that goes to the Canucks Autism Network Pro-Am. Come say hi. We'll talk some Canucks next with Dan Murphy. Who needed that weekend the most on the Canucks roster? He'll answer that question next right here on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Canucks win the draw. Here's Miller for the left point. Back to the right side. Stetcher scores. Troy Stetcher with a long wrist shot for the point. Off is set up by Miller on the left wing.
Troy Stetcher sniping. JT Miller, another strong weekend for him. I enjoy the debate. I enjoy the back and forth. You can always find me on Twitter at Scott Rintoul. We welcome it. We want that on this show. healthy conversation, good debate. That's what sports talk is all about. That's why you're a sports fan. If we all agreed, it wouldn't be a whole lot of fun, would it? So I enjoy the debate. I think JT Miller has been their best player through 46 games. Now, as soon as I put that out there again on the weekend, it was in conversation with something that was going on with Sat. I had a bunch of people crack back saying, no, it's Jacob Markstrom. It's not even close. I think it is close. I think Markstrom is an excellent choice, and I'm not going to tell you you're a damn fool for choosing Jacob Markstrom as their best player this year. I'm not going to do that. I think, personally, biggest impact has been JT Miller. I think it goes beyond the points, beyond the goals, beyond the faceoffs. I think it goes far beyond that. I think it's a leadership on the ice and off the ice. I think it's all of those different things. So that, for me, has been their best player. But you can choose yours. Bad news for the Toronto Maple Leafs, and that probably brings a smile to your face when you hear it, but it's the way this bad news comes about that maybe you won't feel so good about. I certainly don't. You never like to see injuries. You don't like to see them to star players. You certainly don't like to see them to star players who hail from this neck of the woods. Morgan Rielly, he's going to be out a minimum of 8 weeks. Fractured foot. Tough blow for a team that has just given up 8 goals in a loss to Florida and has had its share of defensive worries throughout the course of this season. And they lose him for a minimum of 8 weeks. That's tough news for the kid from this neck of the woods, a guy Dan Murphy sees from time to time on the North Shore. Murph joining us from Winnipeg. I know you're no Leafs fan, Murph, but that sucks, doesn't it?
Hollyburn, baby. Hollyburn Country Club. Yeah, that sucks. He's such a nice kid. He's been playing through a lot this season. That's been chronicled here recently. But, you know, I guess the main thing is they want to have him healthy and back ready for the playoffs, which is the most important time. So, you know, I'm sure that they thought long and hard about this and how they wanted to go about it. But what was it, 2 weeks ago he said he'd been playing through something all season long. So I guess it was time to try to get him healed.
Murph, tough loss for you yesterday. I saw you sporting the Seahawks tie. They just dug too deep a hole, didn't they?
Yeah, it's frustrating. Sometimes the way Pete coaches, but he brought the franchise a Super Bowl. Forever grateful for that, but it just seems like they don't allow Russ to open it up early, and they always get behind and try to come back, and Wilson's been able to do that in his career, make those fourth-quarter comebacks, but you're playing with fire. And it caught them again. Listen, even if they won yesterday, they weren't going to go into San Fran and win that game, not with the amount of injuries they've had. But it's frustrating because they probably should have had a better chance at winning that game yesterday and not by trying to crawl out of the big hole like it always seems to happen with Pete. Playing with fire all year long. I mean, how many one-score games do they have go in their favor? So you knew they were due for one to go against, and that's for sure.
Kind of crazy to me how much an inch matters. After that Seahawks 49ers game in week 17, you know, it's 1 inch, it's 2 inches, whatever it is. If it's different, Jacob Hollister gets over the line, and we're talking about a different conversation in the NFC playoff picture because San Fran was a little bit banged up and they needed the 2 weeks rest. It's amazing how 2 inches, Murph, alters the course of the playoffs in the National Football League.
Yeah, and but I mean, let's not forget that the Seahawks lost the game before that too. So I would agree. I mean, if the Seahawks got a home game, maybe, and they had a week to recover, but they weren't going to get Carson back. They weren't getting Penny back. They weren't getting Prosafe back. So not any of the running backs were going to help out. Defensively, perhaps. We saw that Clowney was, you know, still hurt yesterday. So I'm not sure what would have happened. I don't think, you know, if you ask me where they would rank in the NFC, I don't think the Seahawks are you know, first or second, maybe even third best team in the NFC. So I don't think they had the horses issue to do it. And, you know, probably they punched above their weight class for most of the season, due mainly to their quarterback. So, you know, it's disappointing. I think it would have been super exciting for a Seahawks-Niners game. But I'm not convinced the Seahawks would have had much of a chance against that Niners defense.
I know you guys are in Winnipeg right now. I kind of feel bad for you, not just because you're in Winnipeg, but this is the only game on the five-game set that's in Canada. It might have been nice to be in an American city tonight for the college national championship just to have that atmosphere.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we'll watch it anyway, that game. And, you know, we kind of got a little bit screwed with the travel because, you know, that Seahawks game, the whole thing was on when we were in the air. And, in fact, I mean, I guess it was – before we took off, I think they made it 21-3. I think we saw that when we were still on the plane getting de-iced. Paul Alby, the cameraman for the Canucks, had his Dazoon going, so we were watching it on his phone. And then the last few plays when Rogers got the first down, that's right when we were descending, so we didn't see much of it. And, you know, we didn't see the game the week before, too, because we were traveling. So kind of got a little bit of hooped with back-to-back afternoon games Saturday, Sunday, if you were an NFL fan, because you couldn't get to watch a whole bunch. Although I will say this, I was paying attention to the Canucks and Wild, but I did have that crazy Texans-Chiefs games on a TV beside me as well, so I got to see most of that game yesterday.
Dude, that was football on crack.
I know. It was crazy. It was crazy. And, you know, I'm sure that the Texans fans are, you know, up in arms a little bit over a couple of those calls that Bill O'Brien made early. But, man, you know, when you go down 24-0, it didn't look good for the Chiefs, but that offense they have is something else.
Dan Murphy joining us from Winnipeg. The Canucks finishing up their five-game road set tomorrow night against the Jets. They've evened the score after getting blown out in back-to-back games in Florida. Murph, which Canuck player needed this past weekend the most?
Oh, boy. Well, I'm not going to say Markstrom because he's been so solid, you know, for most of the season. I think Besser needed some goals. I understand he was still close to a point-a-game guy, but, you know, his goal-scoring rates are not exactly or weren't exactly where people wanted him to be, but now he's on pace for, I think, 29 goals, which would be just fine to get up close to 30. I think he would be one. And if I had to pick another, I don't know. I mean, I just think, oh, man. It's tough to say. I'm going to say Besser just because he got those a couple goals. I know he didn't have one yesterday, but the two-goal game in Buffalo, I think that gives him a little juice moving forward. I don't want to say Horvat because I think he's been pretty solid here the last couple of weeks. So let's say Besser.
Yeah, and Horvat's goals seem to be of the puck luck variety for a lot of them. I'm not taking them away. They all count. The third goal that Besser scored in these last two games, the last one he scores in Buffalo, that to me is the most positive sign because that's the type of Brock Besser goal we're used to seeing over the last couple of years, isn't it?
Yeah, and he found, it was a great play by Tanev as well, who took the puck, and I think he probably wanted to shoot it, but once he got off balance, he noticed Brock, who slid into that little area where nobody was and got off that, you know, patented wrist shot. So, you know, I think we all know that when Brock's playing well, he moves his feet, because he's not the, you know, not the fattest, the fastest skater. He's not the quickest skater, and he needs to use his feet to get into those spaces. But I think for the most part, all season long, while he would, yes, like to score more, I think that, you know, some of those underlying metrics do say that he is becoming more of a complete player, but you don't want to lose, you know, sight of his most important quality, and that is to score goals.
Pretty big few days for Quinn Hughes. Picks up a couple of points in the weekend, but also obviously gets voted in to the All-Star game. I saw his comment, Murph, where he said, I knew I was going to create and have some offense, but it's really buoyed me that they've shown trust in me defensively. Has he been better defensively than you would have expected?
No question. Far better. I mean, I think he was just phenomenal yesterday in Minnesota. Because I think his worst game of the season was, in Minnesota. His worst game of the season was probably in Florida. But yes, I wondered about his ability to defend. And what was it, game one of the season when McDavid kind of blew by him and scored that goal? Did they play Edmonton first or Calgary first? I can't even remember. But there was a couple
Edmonton.
Of times early. Yeah, a couple times early we kind of got bested by some of the world's best players. I think the pairing with Tanev has helped tremendously. But the confidence the coaching staff has in that pairing to be shut down defenders. You know, obviously the fact that he's got the puck a lot and he can break out a lot on his own, that's going to help you defend. But there's, you know, if I was going to, you know, pick some of the most surprising storylines for the Canucks this season, that would be one, if not two, his ability to defend. Because I was with everybody else. I didn't know about his size in that. I didn't know if he would be able to use his angles and his skating as well as he has. But I think it's been just a revelation for, you know, not only the fan base, but I think also probably the coaching staff.
he's been at the top end of the defenseman food chain. At the other end, a guy who's been in the lineup a lot recently but wasn't at the start of the year, Oscar Fantenberg. What are Canucks coaches saying about his play?
Predictable, I think, is the one thing they're saying. Steady, doesn't seem to make a ton of mistakes. I covered the when Vegas in the first year, so I did the first two rounds of the playoffs, and they played the Kings, of course, in the first round. They swept them 4-0. But Fantenberg was playing for LA, and he had back-to-back games and that where they lost, but he had just been put into the lineup, and he played great. And so it was kind of the first time I had ever really been exposed to him. I didn't know much about him. Went to Calgary last year in the trade, and I don't think he played a whole lot. But for the most part, I just think they think he's reliable and predictable. And I think if you're looking at a third pair defenseman, those are two qualities you're going to want.
Dan Murphy on the road in Winnipeg with the Vancouver Canucks. He joins us here on the Scott Rintoul Show on your home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. The power play. We know how important it's been to this team over the course of the year. Where do you think it's at lately?
I thought it was not very good at all yesterday. And this is after in Buffalo where it didn't connect, but I thought there was more urgency, better puck movement, more shots. So I thought it was trending in the right direction after that game. But yesterday was a little stagnant, 5-on-3. They got nothing going. They didn't move the puck. They didn't get any shots. They didn't create any havoc. And, I know you have skill players there. I know you want to let them make plays. But anytime you have a 5-on-3, you have to get the puck to the net because you outnumber the defenders. That's where you can jump on loose pucks. That's where you can get the rebound. So I just thought that yesterday there wasn't enough puck movement. There wasn't enough player movement. And sometimes that's why that second unit looks better than the first, because they're not afraid to be more direct. They're not afraid to shoot the puck and see if they can get goals that way. So, I never want to stifle creativity, but I think when things aren't going well, you kind of have to be a little more meat and potatoes with things. And I think that's something that first unit, when it's not connecting, can get back to doing.
If you didn't watch the game, you might not know how strong Markstrom was, especially in the late stages. He made a couple of saves of that right pad and blocker, Murph, that were just phenomenal and kept it a 3-1 scoreline. And basically, that was the final nail in the coffin for the Minnesota Wild. He was really good yesterday.
But how many times have we said this year, Scott, when the Canucks have won games, whether the score seems like it's out of hand, not that a 3-1 score or a 4-1 score seems out of hand, but there's been a number of games where you looked at the score and you didn't watch the game, you'd think there's no way your goaltender is one of the best players. Where there's been at least 5 or 6 games where the score has seemed out of hand, but it wouldn't have been that way if not for Markstrom making some, 5 bell saves. Late in that game yesterday, if you're following Michael Russo, who is a writer for The Athletic on Twitter, he couldn't believe some of the saves that Markstrom made, robbing Cunning. I think Stahl was in there, Parisi. Just made some huge saves, and that makes a huge difference. If they score with 6 minutes remaining and are down one, then it could be a whole different ball game. So, I think that at least made Travis Green look pretty good, because some were questioning before the game why Markstrom would start on back-to-back days. It was the third time this season it's happened. The first two, it didn't go well. Lost to Edmonton after the travel and lost after travel in Vegas. So I think that at least – affirm the decision from Travis Green and the goaltender once again made his coach look pretty good.
Makes sense to start Demko tomorrow to me. Does it make sense to you?
Yeah, I don't know what they're going to do though. I would agree. This is the reason why you have him. This is he played great in October. He's had a couple of outings where he hasn't been at his best, but you can't let your goaltender go stale. This rink in Winnipeg here is turned into Vancouver's little house of horrors. It used to be the XL Energy Center, but now it's Winnipeg. I think they're 9-1-1 in the past 10 here against Vancouver, and none of those games have seemed close. So I know Winnipeg's struggling. I think they've lost 6 straight on home ice overall. But you have to get Demko back in there at some point. Let the kid get some confidence again. You're going to want to even out that workload a little bit as we get into the second half of the season here. So I would agree it makes sense, but with no practice today, I haven't even talked to any coaches. I don't know what the plan is, but I'm with you. I think that at the end of this road trip, get him in, and then you've got 2 more starts, right, before the All-Star bye week. Is it Thursday, Saturday? And you can go with marks from both those if you want.
Yeah, and there's some gravity to that game on Thursday against Arizona Coyotes, first of the four meetings. So I would want Markstrom ready and raring to go for that. I agree with you wholeheartedly. Dan Murphy joining us here from Winnipeg. Cassian, Tkachuk, let's start with the hits. Did you have a problem with any of them?
I had a problem with the first one. And, you know, we covered Rafi Torres. And it seems like those were the hits he was getting trouble for, coming down from the hash marks to hit a forward below the goal line while that forward's engaged with a defender. I remember Torres doing that, I believe, to Eberle and getting a couple games and then doing it again. And those seem like the exact sort of hits that Tkachuk delivered. And it's a little shocking to me that they aren't getting looked at. So, yeah, I thought the first one was I didn't have as much problems with the second one. But to me, the first one, in my mind, looked like a dirty hit. It looked like his hip caught the head of Cassian. And I don't think it was shoulder contact first. I think it was the hip to the head that caused the helmet to pop off. So, yeah, I had a problem with the first hit.
Yeah, you and I are on the same page there. I had a problem with the first one, not so much the second one. I think that is a cleaner hit. I know it's that sneaky, dirty play because he's got a defender with him as well. You and I would both agree that Cassian at some point has to stop. When he realizes Tkachuk's not going to fight, he can't keep wailing away. It's probably going to get him a game or two here, isn't it?
Yeah, probably two games, I would think. And again, like I think I don't have a problem with Cassian reacting that way. I kind of wish that the coach would have had his back a little more post-game. But, you know, he did take the penalties that led to the winning goal on the power play for Calgary. And you've got two teams that are, like, right in the heat of a playoff race. So it did cost his team, and it will cost some more if he's suspended, because he has been a top-line player for them this season. And the other thing, too, is that, you know, if you have Tkachuk, and I do, I think he's an elite, elite crap disturber in the league. I think he plays that role of the heel perfectly. And not fighting there goes, you know, right along with it. And I don't really have a problem with him not fighting there if he draws the penalty. But I will say this, that you're going to get to a point now where if he's not stepping up, players will start to take a look at Gaudreau, start to take a look at Lindholm, start to target other players, and I guarantee you they will if Tkachuk is not willing to answer the bell. So I would never say a reckoning's coming for someone. I think that Kachuk's a dynamite player. I think he plays the heel perfectly, and I think that he clearly wins round one of this one, but it could have, you know, some of his teammates in danger if he's not careful.
Yeah, it could. And I think you're right about one to two games. And you said two. It makes sense. Darnell Nurse got two games for a similar incident with Roman Polak here in recent years. And if he gets two games, guess what he's back for? He's back for the next one.
Yeah, I know. I know. And it was a fantastic game. I got lucky to watch it. But, man, that was a fun game from start to finish. The pace, the viciousness. I just thought it was a fantastic hockey game. I'm looking forward to the one on 29.
Do you make any sense of Pacific Division right now?
No, I don't know. Like, I mean, I know it's a weak division. I mean, I think that, you know, if you look at goal differential and some of the metrics, it's probably the weakest in the league. But I don't know how it's going to pan out. I believe, and I have always believed, that Vegas is the best team, but that they're lulling a bit. If you look at points percentage, I think Vancouver's number two with Arizona's result yesterday, but I'd have to go back and look. I know Vancouver was number one after the win yesterday, but Arizona played after. I don't know what to, I have no idea what to make of it. Do you want to bet against McDavid? I don't know. I think that the goaltending has been a question mark a little bit in both of those markets, Edmonton and Calgary, whereas in Vancouver, it's kind of been one of the better stories. So I really don't know. Like, I have no idea what to think. Arizona without Kemper is in trouble. But I think I wouldn't be surprised with any scenario, with any one of those teams finishing in or out of the playoffs, because it's just too close to call.
And the math tells us that all of a sudden it's going to be a fun March. It's going to be a fun March in Vancouver. Whether the Canucks get in or they don't, we're going to have a March that we haven't had in a long time.
No question. And, I think if you look at the remaining schedule, Vancouver's got one of the tougher ones as far as Pacific Division teams go. And at Calgary, I think, has one of the easiest ones in terms of the league. So you can look at that. But this is what this ownership and management group wanted This is why they paid a first round to get Miller, a first round pick. This is why they signed Myers, and you can debate whether it was worth it all you want. I still tend to think it wasn't for that term and money, but they wanted to have a team that could compete and hopefully make a playoff spot. And you can argue whether that's the right direction to make, to make those signings and make those trades to just squeak into the playoffs. But I think that I think this market does need to see playoff games sooner rather than later. And so, you know, as of now, if they make the playoffs, was it worth it? We'll have to wait and see. But I think if they do make the playoffs, I would probably start to lean that that trade for JT Miller was worth it and the price that they paid.
Dan Murphy in Winnipeg, where he'll be doing push-ups at Portage and Main later today.
It's too cold out there, man. It's like 16 or 17 below right now. But there's less snow, I think, than in Vancouver, so maybe I'm winning that way.
Yeah, dude, at your house, that driveway is, I'm telling you, there's probably 7-8 inches of snow that fell last night.
Christy better get out there and shovel it before I get home.
Class act as always, pal. Good stuff, buddy.
All right. We'll talk to you.
Talk to you. That's Dan Murphy from Winnipeg. Yeah, he's a catch, ladies. He's a catch. Get out there. Shovel it before he gets home. Text messages continue to pour in on the Cassian Tkachuk incident. We'll take your submissions on the Vancouver Canucks as well. 650-650 is the Subway text line. Dan Riccio, Randeep Jander going to join me here momentarily. We'll do Canucks Central live here in Ladner. We're at 4989 Bridge Street. That's Dunbar Lumber. We're here for the bulk of the afternoon. These guys are going to do their show here until 4 o'clock today. Triple O's is on hand. You come here, you get lunch. $5 from your combo from Triple O's goes to the Canuck Autism Network Pro-Am. You can come here and donate. Say hi. Talk some Canucks hockey with us next on the home of the Vancouver Canucks, Sportsnet 650.